Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 16. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This episode is going to be quite different than the usual format. I've decided to bring on some topics that are not directly related to shamanism or religion or entheogens, but is related to our collective consciousness and our awareness as a whole. And I felt that this was a very important podcast to present and for people to hear because it provides information that is really left out of the mainstream media, and for that matter, out of consciousness in general, as I find it. And first off, I'll start off with an interview that I did back in early December with Dr. John Loftus, JD, who is the former top U.S. Justice Department prosecutor under the Carter and Reagan administrations. And he will be on to discuss his investigations into the history of the Bush family crimes, such as funding the Nazis, the creation of Al-Qaeda, working with the Muslim Brotherhood, and things like that. And following that, I will read an article that I wrote back in 1997 called The True Definitions of Liberal, Leftist, and Conservative. And this part may seem a little bit long to some of you, but I hope that you won't skip through it and that you listen to the whole part of that, as I personally feel that the word liberal is one of the most misused words in the entire English lexicon, if not even further historically. And interestingly, even the Bible talks about the misuse of the word liberal and its misuse needing to stop. And not that I'm some Bible thumper, but in Isaiah 32:5, it says, quote, "The vile person shall no more be called liberal, nor the churl said to be called bountiful." And obviously the vile person here, if we look it up in Strong's Exhaustive Concordance of the Bible, is translated as a fool or scum, etc. And a churl is someone who is a miser, who is stingy, and they're not to be called bountiful. So a fool, a stingy person, these are not qualities of a liberal, and the Bible very clearly says that these types of people shall no more be called liberal. And even today, throughout the corporate media, if we search online, in fact, I even came across online articles that discuss this very passage in the book of Isaiah that completely twist the meaning of what is said there, trying to make it out that God is against liberals and that liberals are vile people. But that is clearly not what it's saying. It says, vile person shall no more be called liberal, nor the churl said to be called bountiful. And in Isaiah 32:8, it says, quote, "But the liberal deviseth liberal things, and by liberal things he shall stand." And obviously, what is being very clearly said here is that liberals will stand on their own, the true liberals, by their actions, and that vile people and the stingy people, the fools out there, are not liberal and should not be called as such. And after I read that article, I will go into an interview with Professor Michel Cholsudovsky on the Israeli invasion of Gaza. And this interview is from Pacifica Radio's KPFA up in Berkeley, their Guns and Butter show from last week, or actually 2 weeks ago. This is a phenomenal interview. It's something you definitely don't want to miss. If you think you have some idea of what's going on in Gaza between Israel and the Palestinians, you'd better hear this show. And following that, I'm going to play the audio only from a documentary film called The War Crimes of Henry Kissinger. And finally, I'm going to end the show with a short talk by Nobel Prize winner Harold Pinter from his 2005 acceptance speech. And unfortunately, Pinter left the world on Christmas Eve of 2008, but he's left a legacy behind him. And this podcast is lengthy, but each piece is providing context to the next and building a bigger picture. And it's sort of a stream of consciousness, so listen at your leisure and explore the possibilities. And donations, last week there were absolutely no donations, and I need to remind the listeners that to survive and continue to do this show, we do require your donations, without which we cannot continue to do the shows. It takes a lot of time and money to produce these, and your help is greatly appreciated. We're not corporate media, and by donating to the show, you're showing your support for not only the show and its continuation, but you know, it goes into other projects and future documentary films that I would like to do, etc. So without you, we don't survive. So if you haven't made a donation recently, please do, and every bit helps. And you know, I do hate to come on and beg each week to, you know, ask everybody for donations, but we have to. And this is how this podcast and many others survive. And it's the way of alternative media. And even the good public media is run on donations and not corporate sponsored. So please support the program if you can, whatever donation you can make, large or small. If you're not interested in a donation, possibly you might be interested in buying one of the books from the website. My latest book, The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity. I do have autographed copies of that available. I also have the second edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism available for the first 100 numbered and signed, and the first 25 of those I will be sending a free Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD along with that. And so I know it's more expensive than the black and white version if you want a color version of that, but you are supporting the show and everything that we do here, so it's greatly appreciated. If you would like a black and white edition, that is now available and shipping. I expected to have those in Saturday's mail, but hopefully they will be here Monday today for going out. If not, those should be going out by Tuesday or Wednesday to everyone. I do know that they are on the way, and I expect them any minute. And let's see. If you would like to purchase other books instead of maybe one of my books, if you go to the GnosticMedia.com link on the website and then click on from there, any purchases that you make, whether it's one of my books or another book, Amazon will provide a associate percentage of that, and it's of no additional cost to you, but it does help support the show, and they'll give me like 50 cents or a dollar for each book that you buy that helps to pay the bills here and keep things going. And also up on Amazon is the black and white version, as well as up on the Gnostic Media website, of the second edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism, and that is $20.99 plus shipping and handling. It's less than half the cost of the color edition. And also on the Gnostic Media website are t-shirts and things like that that you can get through the Cafe Press link down on the bottom left. If you, you know, it says t-shirts and things like that. And if you buy a t-shirt with Gnostic Media or an Ouroboros or a mushroom or something on it, I think they give me 50 cents or a dollar for something like that for each business referral. I do not handle those. That is just an associate link. They print the shirts, they ship the shirts and do all of the work, and all I do is get a very small percentage off of that if you buy a shirt or something from the website. And also available on the Gnostic Media website are the She Who Remembers audio archives down on the bottom right. That's about 500 hours worth of audio that was recorded by Jeannie Brenningham Erstad, a.k.a. She Who Remembers, who died in 2002. And I've run her archives since her death in April of 2002. And her legacy still continues. There are still news groups and things running her name. And it's still actually the best quality news that I get on a daily basis for the last 10 years, even after her passing and 8 years ago, is still through the She Who Remembers news archives and news feeds. And for those of you who have still not seen the Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD that I did with Andrew Rutaji, that is also up on the website for free. And I encourage you to make a donation or to buy a copy if you like the video. And that, again, helps support the show. We had zero sales in the last week and zero donations. So there you have it. Upcoming shows. Next week, I'm going to do a little change up with the guest that I had in mind because I was ill for the last couple weeks. I did not get a couple of the interviews done that I wanted to, but I did get a couple of others done instead. I did do an interview with Jack Hare at his home up in Northern California, as well as Rick Simpson from Canada. He's from Phoenix Tears, and he's done a documentary film called Run From the Cure, and this is some mind-blowing stuff. You won't want to miss that. And of course, Jack Hare is probably one of, if not the most famous activist in probably the world. Jack is the author of the famed book The Emperor Wears No Clothes, and he and I have been very good friends for about 17 or 18 years. Coming up, interviews will include Ernest Werner, and we'll be discussing his book, The Rod of Jesse. He's a former Christian minister of 50 years. Also, Professor Michael Winkelman from Arizona State and his book, Supernatural is Natural, A Biocultural Approach to Religion. I also plan on having Dr. Dennis McKenna on soon, Judith Ann Brown, who is the daughter of Dead Sea Scrolls scholar and author of The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, John Marco Allegro. Also, Professor Carl Ruck will be coming back on the show to discuss his book, The Hidden World. And Professor Thomas Roberts, who is the author of Psychedelic Horizons, as well as Psychedelic Medicine, and the editor of Psychoactive Sacramentals, Essays on Entheogens and Religion. And if you'd like to contact me directly, you can reach me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And go to the website at www.gnosticmedia.com, that's GNOSTICmedia.com, and you can check out some of the other projects there, like Hemp for Fuel, and like I've already mentioned, the She Who Remembers archives, and all of that good stuff is up there. And without further ado, here we go. And just to warn you, this podcast is going to be interspersed with music and other ideas to bring the concepts together. That, let's go.
Are you ready, Jesus? Buddha.
Yeah.
Muhammad.
Okay.
We're all right, guys.
Let's go!
Drives across a blood red sky, moon in from the east towards the west, with balaclava helmets over the hills.
Yes.
If you think that Jesus Christ is coming, honey, you've got another thing coming. If he ever finds out who's hijacked his name, he'll cut out his heart and turn in his.
Islam is rising.
thank the good Lord for raising the Union Jack. You watch a ship sail out of harbor and the bodies come floating back. Watch a ship sail out of harbor and the bodies come floating back. But if you think that Jesus Christ is coming, honey, you got another thing coming. If he ever finds out who's hijacked his name, he'll cut out his heart and turn in his grave.
I'm going to jump right into my interview with John Loftus. Enjoy. I'm here with John Loftus, who has a very interesting background working with the U.S. government and a very interesting educational background as well. John, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I had sort of an odd thing. I went to Boston Latin School and Boston College to a double degree. A master's in public administration, a doctor of laws at Suffolk, and then did my postdoctoral work at Georgetown. And in between there, I managed to scramble to become a paratroop army infantry officer. So
wow! So you're
a weird background.
So you're a PhD with an army infantry background.
A JD, Juris Doctor. Yeah.
Gotcha.
And it seemed like a good idea at the time, jumping on a perfectly good airplane. Ended up in Army Hospital for a while, but, young and stupid, thought I'd live forever. But anyway, because I did so many things simultaneously, the Attorney General of the United States thought that I might make a good intern, so I became a law clerk on the Attorney General's Office Program at the headquarters of the Justice Department. And during the Carter and Reagan administrations, I became GS-13 supervisory trial attorney and handled CIA cases and Nazi war crimes cases until one day I discovered that many of the Nazis I was supposed to prosecute were on the CIA payroll. I ended up being a whistleblower on 60 Minutes. Mike Wallace won the Emmy Award. Congressman hearings. My family got the death threats. It was a great trade-off. Ever since then, I've sort of been the lawyer for whistleblowers inside the U.S. government.
So you've sort of got a background in government and investigations and war crimes and Nazis and things like that, I would say, correct?
Yeah, and then I had really high security clearances. So now I'm the president of an international charity called the IntelligenceSummit.org, and we get people from 38 different democratic countries who come, and we have an annual conference. We sort of exchange ideas about the way the world really works, sometimes things that our politicians don't want to hear. But it's kind of fun. So I'm a professional troublemaker, I guess.
Yeah. And my understanding is that you actually held the highest security clearance in the land under both Carter and Reagan. Is that true?
Yeah, it was had a cosmic clearance for NATO top secret, a Q clearance for nuclear weapons secrets, and an SI clearance for code word secrets. So a little bit of everything.
So it seems like you probably know what you're talking about then.
Well, actually, no. I'm not stupid, but I've got 600 clients. They pay me a buck a piece. I'm the worst paid lawyer in America, but I'm only better informed because all of my clients are folks from the intelligence community. And sometimes I work with them to help them get things declassified, and sometimes move things into the public arena that people really should know about. Testified before Congress and several other countries. Do my own little radio show. Used to do a gig on Fox News until I found out I was a Democrat.
So I've got a really deep question for you. Is the truth left?
Okay.
Is the truth left or is it right?
No, the truth isn't Democrat or Republican. The truth is what it is. You know, history is too important to ascribe it to politics. And I've been accused or complimented as being postpartisan. I think we have to move beyond traditional categories and find the truth wherever it is, whatever it leads. And sometimes it's unpopular. You know, I'm the Democrat, for example, that thought that probably Bush was a little bit right about the WMD. And as Saddam's intelligence files get translated, it looks like he really did have some of the stuff. But bottom line, everybody was a little bit right, everybody was a little bit wrong. But we have to admit that, you know, we need to know what happened. We can't just bend history to suit our political orientations. The truth is just too important for that. So it doesn't belong to left or right. The truth just is what it is. It's important in some account.
I couldn't agree with you more. Could you tell me what is the U.S.'s historical relationship to Al-Qaeda?
You know, it's a sad story. It goes back to at World War II, there was an Arab Nazi movement called the Muslim Brotherhood, and British intelligence hired them after the war, sort of a proxy army to have the Arab Nazis fight the Arab communists. And then the British sold the Arab Nazi movement to us, to a nitwit named Alan Dulles, who was our CIA director at the time. Now, the British genius that sold us the Arab Nazi was the guy named Kim Philby. Turned out to be a Soviet spy. It was all a big con game. And the Arab Nazi movement was completely penetrated with Arab communists. It was just a horrible, horrible group. But Dulles fell for it. We hid the Arab Nazis in Saudi Arabia. And every once in a while, we'd take the Arab Nazis out of the closets to fight a proxy war with the Arab communists. The last time we did that was in early 1980s, where we used the Muslim Brotherhood to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. And it was a complete Muslim Brotherhood operation. You know, we called them the Mujahideen because the Muslim Brotherhood was too identified with the Nazis at the time. But, it was really stupid. We really did it. American foreign policy sometimes has just been unbelievably stupid. So we hired the most right-wing people possible. And, of course, at the end of the war in 89, we drove the Russians out. The CIA declared victory and went home, and leaving this entire army of Arab Nazis out in the field. Now, the roster for for the people that went to the Mujahideen training classes was the base of this movement, and the word for the base just means Al-Qaeda. It literally means a training roster of the base of the people that went through. And bin Laden's people put check marks behind the most right-wing people. So they split the Mujahideen movement down the middle and taking the ultra-right of the old Arab Nazi movement and had it become a new ultra-fascist Islamic terrorist movement. When you think about it, you know, the old Arab Nazis and Al-Qaeda really had the same goal. They're against Western civilization, against Christianity, against Judaism, against democracy. It's just old wine in new bottles. So there's not a lot of difference between the World War II Arab Nazi movement and Al-Qaeda in terms of ideology. And yeah, we had them on the payroll in places like Chechnya. And, of course, now most of the stuff was still run by the British. But because the British are our allies, we cover up for them. But yeah, we sort of helped create Al-Qaeda. Now, the CIA, ironically, is the agency least responsible because they knew the least about it. The CIA money went to the Saudis and the Pakistan. The Pakistanis ran the operations, and so we had what's called plausible deniability.
Fascinating history. Is there a historical relationship to Afghanistan, the drug trade, and the U.S. government?
No, I don't think so. My friend Rachel Ehrenfeld is recognized as probably the world's best expert on drug trade and terrorist groups, and it's not one supported by the U.S. That's an old rumor that grew up because of Air America back in the Vietnam days when I was a kid. And essentially, the Air America group would fly out crops and supplies out from the Hmong guerrilla groups that we supported. And sometimes the Hmong would put mail on board. Well, the mail was, 20 kilo sacks wrapped in brown paper. We sort of knew it was in it. We knew that they were smuggling out opium, but everybody sort of turned a blind eye to it. But that's where the rumor began that the CIA was involved in smuggling out opium. We just were checking the carry-on baggage, but they really weren't helping smuggling opium. They're just sort of looking the other way when these guys did it. But anyway, from that little rumor grew this entire industry of the CIA involved with the drug trade. Don't think it's even remotely true. Quite frankly, the U.S. government has been pressing so hard to suppress the drug trade in Afghanistan that it's almost caused a civil war. I mean, these farmers are dirt poor. They need to grow something, and the most money they get is from opium poppies. That's because, I guess, we win the war and we lose the peace. We never subsidize nation building after the war is over. We walked away from Afghanistan after the Soviets pulled out.
I guess that should be
horrible mistake.
That should be separated, though, from the Iran-Contra scandal and the drug trade, though, correct?
Yeah, again, the Iran-Contra scandal. I'm one of Ollie North's greatest critics. The guy was a complete idiot. But there's the same thing where we had a couple of guys that were running drugs on the side and trying to dress themselves up and disguise themselves by being supporters of the U.S. Same thing happened with the Mugen Hand Bank in Australia. These guys would find out which banks the CIA was using to move its covert operations money and move the drug money to the same bank. And they were trying for gray mail. But, I've been looking at this stuff for a long time. I never found any credible evidence that the CIA was behind drug smuggling. There were some people in the Pentagon, I believe, that did dabble in this stuff a little bit. And I am trying my best to get those few individuals identified. But by and large, it's not a conspiracy. It's just sharks swimming in parallel lines. It's hard for a lot of people to accept, but, sharks get greedy. They smell blood in the water. They all head in the same area. Doesn't mean they're working in concert.
Understood. How has the Bush family and the CIA been involved with the Nazis and Muslim ties?
It's funny. I'm an old Democrat from Boston, and people used to say, President Kennedy's dad bought Nazi stocks. What they don't realize is he bought them from George Bush's granddaddy. That Prescott Bush and Joseph Kennedy went to Germany together before the war. That there was this whole group of Wall Street bankers that hated Teddy Roosevelt because he made monopolies illegal, and they moved their money out of America into Germany. And and bought up all the German corporate stock and, quite frankly, helped fund the Nazi Party's rise. And, you know, it's an ugly fact of history. I've got a film that will be coming out next year. Well, it's not my film. I'm just in it a lot. It's called American Secrets, about the history of American corporations that got in bed with the Nazis and how it became the Arab Nazi movement after the war, and so how some of our biggest corporations actually helped fund Al-Qaeda for what they thought was the sake of oil out of Afghanistan. You know, history is 90% stupidity, 10% conspiracy.
Interesting statistics, either way you look at it. Well, you mentioned both Arab Nazis and the Muslim Brotherhood. Could you go into a little bit more background so that the listeners can get a deeper understanding of what that is?
It's real easy. If your listeners want to find out more, just Google two words, Nazi and Banna, B-A-N-N-A. B as in boy, A-N-N-A. And Hassan al-Banna was the founder of the Arab Nazi movement. He was the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, great admirer of Adolf Hitler in back in the late 20s. And they corresponded frequently, and he had his Palestinian representative, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, became Hitler's favorite Nazi. And the Grand Mufti was personally briefed by Hitler on the Holocaust. And one of Hitler's aides said, "My God, my fellow, why would you tell such a state secret to this Arab?" He said, "Because they agree with our point of view so completely." Hitler even allowed the Grand Mufti to go to Auschwitz to cheer on the German guards to greater efficiency. So there was a small group of Arab Muslims who were pro-Nazi. A lot of them were in the Saudi royal family, to be honest with you. But, none of them were prosecuted after the war. They got away with it. But anyway, if you Google Banna and Nazi, you'll find a whole series of articles from around the world on this topic. I think the Asian Times series was the best. But it's unfortunately a sad part of history. The Arab Nazi movement was the only one never prosecuted for war crimes or atrocities. They got away with it, and they have rebuilt themselves. And now the Muslim Brotherhood is sort of the overall umbrella for all of the Sunni-based terrorist groups. So we're still fighting World War II. We're still fighting Nazi terrorism. I hate the word Islamofascism because it makes it seem as if Islam has fascist tendencies. That's absolutely untrue. I'm Irish Catholic, but I'm a strong defender of the peaceful nature of Islam. What we have, people remember that 85% of all Muslims aren't Arabs. And of the 15% that are Arabs, only 1% belong to the ultra Wahhabi sect or Salafi sect. But because they have the oil, the Wahhabis, the Saudis, of course, we sort of look the other way for a long time. And we've been subsidizing this extreme form of religious bigotry. And after World War II, a lot of the old Arab Nazis moved to Saudi Arabia as a safe haven, and the Saudis employed them as school teachers. So guys like the young Osama bin Laden were literally taught by Nazi propagandists. Qutb was the brother of one of the leading Nazi propagandists, and he was Osama bin Laden's personal tutor. I know it sounds crazy, but that's really what happened. You had a perfect storm of Saudi religious bigotry with Nazi racism. And that, in many ways, is how Al-Qaeda got its ideological roots.
And has George W. Bush broken or strengthened these ties between Al-Qaeda and, say, even between the Saudi royal family?
You know what's funny is that he's sort of irrelevant. George Bush is just a nice little frat boy. He's not the sharpest tool in the shed. He's friendly. He's actually very pro-Israel, but he doesn't have a clue as to how governments run. I think that people say Buchanan is our most incompetent president because he let the Civil War begin. But, the overwhelming majority of historians agree that the W was a close second. He just didn't have a clue as to what Harmon was doing. And he surrounded himself with people like Cheney, who were, I think, hopelessly corrupt and hopelessly biased in favor of the old Arab right wing because they had the oil.
Is there any relation to the Pakistani ISI and the CIA?
Well, yeah, you know, back in the Afghan War, we funneled money to Saudi Arabia and Pakistan to hire, you know, the Mujahideen. Now, Al-Qaeda, by the way, was a small fringe group. They didn't do anything heroic during the war. They came in afterwards. And it was the Taliban, the indigenous ultra-right-wing clerics that the Pakistanis funded. They used the Taliban in as a proxy army in Afghanistan, and they used Lashkar-e-Taiba in Kashmir, L.E.T. And L.E.T., of course, is the group that did the Mumbai bombings last week. Now, what happened is that years ago, the Pakistani intelligence service tried to fire the L.E.T., but it didn't do them any good. They tried to fire the Taliban. Didn't do them any good because these guys have taken on a life of their own. They're being funded, again, by the Saudis and some of the Gulf states. They have a ton of money pouring in, and they're coming back trying to destabilize the region. So, I agree with Jim Woolsey. He was Clinton's CIA director. And Jim said that we will never win the war on terrorism unless we find an alternative to oil. Because as long as the Arabs sell the oil, they will continue to fund terrorism. So that's what my friends and I are working on now. We're trying to find realistic, practical, real-world alternatives to oil.
Well, actually...
We may be closer than people.
Are you there? John?
Yeah.
Actually, a friend of mine has already found an alternative to oil, and he's been offering a $100,000 challenge to prove it wrong for 20 years now, and nobody has been able to take him up on the challenge.
What's his alternative?
His name is Jack Herr.
What's his alternative?
It's actually industrial hemp. And it's been proven time and time again mathematically. In fact, I run a website called hempforfuel.com if you want to check that out. And the information for the $100,000 challenge is there on the website.
Interesting. I think you're going to need something that will convert more directly into the we'll see.
I was just going to say we've already proven the yields and everything in studies, and all of the statistics for it come from old U.S. government growth studies before they banned it in the 1930s.
Oh, yeah, this is used hemp for rope and all that stuff, sure.
Yeah.
And but as a fuel source,
take the challenge and see if you can beat it. I have a friend who works for an oil company who tried to beat it 6 months ago and lost.
Interesting. You know, but I think we need that outside-the-box thinking. I don't know if hemp is the answer, but there's a lot of interesting things being developed right now. Once oil went over $4 a gallon, a lot of people said, well, that's it. We've got to find something different, not something that's, we've got to find something other than oil or coal or burning organic material. There has to be something else, and that's where I think the trend of future research is going.
Right. To steer us back into the conversation, sorry about the little segue there. I wanted to ask you, who are the neocons and how do they relate to the Muslim Brotherhood and to the Nazis?
Well, I don't think the neocons have anything to do with them. Quite frankly, the neocons started as Democrats, people that were around Scoop Jackson, and then the name sort of got hijacked by the Republicans with ultra-right people that thought we should bring democracy to the Middle East. I'm not terribly troubled by the neocons. The good ideas, bad, execution. I think that the whole idea of a neocon conspiracy is kind of ludicrous. To be honest, I just don't think that the U.S. intelligence community really could work together to accomplish much of anything. I'm not a believer in conspiracy theories because my 30 years experience has shown me that it just doesn't work, that we just can't get our act together. If people had a clue as to how disorganized and incompetent our intelligence community was, that's the scary part to me, that we can't do anything right.
At the beginning of the show, you mentioned that you felt we had information on WMDs partly right and partly wrong. Would you discuss that?
Yeah, sure. It's basically Saddam did destroy a quarter of his WMD under UN pressure. Another quarter he sold to his Arab neighbors for profit. Another quarter the Russians dragged away from him in the 3 months before the war, and they hit it across the border in Syria. And the last quarter, you know, there were some nuclear components and material still inside Iraq on the day the war began. So technically, you know, Bush was right, but he was mostly wrong. They didn't even know the stuff was there. There were four underwater warehouses, and all four of them were looted in the 3 years after the war. Everything was down. It was taken out. So it was one screw-up after another. We're finding out now, you know, like 4 years later, as Saddam's intelligence files are being declassified, that the guy really did have WMD programs going up to the few months before the war. But I think it's one of those embarrassing topics that no one on the left or right wants to discuss. You know, I just think that history is important. We should know what happened, that even though Bush was accidentally correct, yeah, Saddam really did have some WMD programs. Not the gigantic ones that were posed, but he did have some of them. As usual, history is somewhere in between.
Right. Did the U.S. have anything to do with Saddam's rise to power?
Well, in a sense, he was a young gunman back in the day. But really, by and large, his group, the Ba'ath Party, was a splinter faction of the Muslim Brotherhood, and he rose to power as a dictatorship. One of the sad things was, for a long time, whatever the Arabs did was fine with us because they had the oil. And the American people, for example, have always been strong supporters of Israel, we want democracy in the Middle East. But our State Department and our intelligence agencies supported the Arabs. They said, because whatever we might say about liking the Jews in public, it really is in America's long-term interest to obtain the cheap and consistent supply of oil. The Arabs had it, the Jews didn't. I mean, if Moses had turned right and settled in Kuwait, we probably would have made Israel the 51st state. But Israel had no oil, so in every war that Israel fought, American intelligence covertly worked on the side of the Arabs. Sometimes with horrific results.
What about, you mentioned you don't think that the government supports Israel as much as the Arabs. What about organizations like AIPAC?
I think they're pretty irrelevant, to tell you the truth. You know, the American Jewish population is one of the smallest ethnic minorities in America. There's less than 80% of the congressional districts have less than 1% Jews. I mean, as far as I can tell, Jewish people are very nice and very active. But from what I'm finding out about the AIPAC case, it turns out that it was Israel that gave the information to the United States that was later leaked by Larry Franklin back to AIPAC. And saying, well, we know this stuff already. So the trial going on now is pretty much a farce and is supposed to end up in a not guilty. Well, we'll see what happens. But no, I think Israel has by and large been a pretty good ally of ours. And I think that they deserve our respect and support. And that's the overwhelming judgment of the American people. Every year we keep electing congressmen and senators who send more of our tax dollars to Israel than any other nation on earth. I think it's probably a good idea. It's nice to have an example of democracy in the Middle East. And it's funny when you do polls among the Arabs, whether they want a British parliamentary-style democracy or an American-style democracy, they all write that they want an Israeli-style democracy. Because they see that it works.
Interesting. What is the treatment of women like in the Middle East?
Pretty terrible. The only place where Muslim women are allowed to run for office is in Israel right now. Although, I take that back. There actually is a new, I think it's Kuwait or Qatar, that has a female ambassador. The women in Iran, ironically, the Shiite states treat women much better than the Sunni states. In Iran, a woman could go to med school and open her own practice and drive her own car. In Saudi Arabia, a woman can't even go out in public without a male escort, let alone drive a car, let alone run her own business, which is kind of hypocritical because Muhammad worked for his wife his entire life. She was a businesswoman who ran camel caravans up to Damascus. and she supported his religious scholarship. I think the old Bedouin bigotry towards women has finally went out in Saudi Arabia and turned Islam upside down.
Would you like to discuss any of your books or videos or your website?
Oh, let me see. I just did a video called Obsession, very controversial because it was someone said 28 million copies of it in newspapers around the country, and it was translating Arab news clips into English and showed what some of the real extremists are really saying. It was kind of a shock to a lot of people, and I was one of the experts they called in to analyze it. So that was a bit of fun. They're going to get into the movie American Secrets will be coming out next year about the Nazis. I've written six books now. Three of them are made into films, and two are bestsellers, and one was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. So I've had a pretty good run. I've had some fun. My website is john-loftus.com, and my organization is intelligencesummit.org. And every year we bring people from intelligence agencies from around the world together, and we invite members of the public and the press, because we think it's important for these people to get to know each other. The rules are very simple. You can't quote who said something, but you can quote what was said, and you can't tell from what agency. So it's a rare chance for members of the public to sit down with a former head of CIA or the Mossad and get to talk with them. I'm all about education as I get older.
I find that true about myself as well. Well, John, I really appreciate you coming on the show. I think you've brought a great balance to some of the other concepts and ideas brought up by some of the other guests on the show, and I very much appreciate your time. And thank you for all of your wonderful research and hard work.
Well, thanks. I think it's important to listen to the left and right, and with respect, and then make up your mind. Truth oftentimes lies somewhere in the middle. Thanks for inviting me. Glad to be on.
liberal, leftist, and conservative. Every day in the mainstream, corporate underwritten, or so-called liberal media, we hear of how all of America's problems can be blamed on the liberals. For those of you who may not know, here are the true definitions of liberal, leftist, and conservative. These definitions are certainly not what most of you currently understand them to be when referring to liberals. First, I will present a 150-year history of definitions of the word liberal via several dictionaries here at my disposal. I will use multiple dictionaries so that there will be no confusion as to the so-called old and new definitions of the word liberal. The dictionaries I will use are, number 1, Webster's An American Dictionary of the English Language, 1853, and that was first published in 1828. Webster's International Unabridged Dictionary of the English Language, 1893. Hearst New Nuttall's Dictionary of the English Language, 1898. Webster's Ninth New Collegiate Dictionary, 1983 to 1990. Oxford English Dictionary, the OED, second edition, 1989, which is the world's most authoritative dictionary at about 20-some volumes. And Webster's Encyclopedic Unabridged Dictionary of the English Language, 1996. Following the breakdown of the word liberal, I will break down the words leftist and conservative, going over what they mean in the political sense today. Finally, I will discuss how these political terms have been used and what that means to you. Is liberal a dirty word? Webster's An American Dictionary of the English Language, 1853, defines liberal as 1. Of a free heart, free to give or bestow, not closed or contracted, munificent, bountiful, generous, giving largely, as in a liberal donor, the liberal founders of a college or hospital. It expresses less than profuse or extravagant. 2. Generous, ample, large, as a liberal donation, a liberal allowance. 3. Not selfish, narrow, contracted, Catholic, and that's with a small c, meaning universal, enlarged, embracing, other interests than one's own, as liberal sentiments or views, a liberal mind, liberal policy. 4. General, extensive, embracing literature and the sciences generally as a liberal education. This phrase is often but not necessarily synonymous with collegiate, as in collegiate education. 5. Free, open, candid, as a liberal communication of thoughts. 6. Large, profuse, as a liberal discharge of matter by secretions or excretions. 7. Free, not literal or strict, as a liberal construction of law. 8. Not mean, not low in birth or mind. 9. Licentious, free to excess. Liberal arts, as distinguished from mechanical arts, are such as depend more on the exertion of the mind than on the labor of the hands, and regard amusement, curiosity, or intellectual improvement rather than necessity of subsistence or manual skill. Such are grammar, rhetoric, painting, sculpture, architecture, music, liberal, has before the thing bestowed, and to be for the person or object on which anything is bestowed, as to be the liberal of praise or censor, liberal to the poor. Liberal. One who advocates greater freedom from restraint, especially in political institutions. Webster's International Unabridged Dictionary of the English Language, 1893. Liberal. 1. Free by birth, hence befitting a free man or gentleman. Refined, noble, independent, free, not servile or mean, as a liberal ancestry, a liberal spirit, liberal arts or studies, liberal education, maculae, a liberal tongue. 2. Bestowing in a large, noble way, as a free man, generous, bounteous, open-handed, as a liberal giver, liberal of praise, Bacon, infinitely good, and of his good, as liberal and free as infinite, Milton. 3. Bestowed in a large way, hence more than sufficient, abundant, bountiful, ample, profuse, as in a liberal gift or a liberal discharge of matter of water. 4. Not strict or rigorous, not confined or restricted in the literal sense. Free. As a liberal translation of a classic or liberal construction of law or language. 5. Not narrow or contracted in mind, not selfish, enlarged in spirit, Catholic with a small c, again meaning universal. 6. Free to excess, regardless of law or moral restraint, licentious, most like a liberal villain. 7. Not bound by orthodox tenets or established forms in political or religious philosophy, independent in opinion, not conservative. Friendly to great freedom in the constitution or administration of government, having tendency toward democratic or republican as distinguished from monarchical or aristocratic forms, as liberal thinkers, liberal Christians, the liberal party. I confess I see nothing liberal in this quote-unquote order of thoughts, end quote, as Hobbes elsewhere expresses it. Hazlitt. Liberal has of, sometimes with, before the thing bestowed, and before a word signifying action, and to before a person or object on which anything is bestowed. As to the liberal of praise or censure, a liberal with money, liberal in giving, liberal to the poor. The liberal arts, see under art. Liberal education, education that enlarges and disciplines the mind and makes it master of its own powers, irrespective of the particular business or profession one may follow. And synonyms are generous, bountiful, munificent, beneficent, ample, large, profuse, free, liberal, generous. Liberal is freeborn, and generous is highborn. The former is opposed to ordinary feelings of a servile state, and implies largeness of spirit in giving, judging, acting, etc. The latter expresses nobleness of the soul and is particularly appropriate to those of high rank, and a spirit that goes out of self and finds its enjoyment in consulting the feelings and happiness of others. Generosity is measured by the extent of the sacrifices it makes. Liberality, by the warmth of feeling which it manifests. Liberal, noun, one who favors greater freedom in political or religious matters. An opponent of the established systems, a reformer. In English politics, a member of the Liberal Party, the so-called Whig. Hearst New Nuttall's Dictionary of the English Language, 1898. Liberal. Giving largely or munificent. Generous, ample, large, not selfish or narrow. Embracing others' interests than one's own. Favorable to liberty and progress. Becoming a gentleman. Refined. Free. Open. Candid. Not too literal. One who advocates greater freedom in political institutions, and more especially their greater popularization. Latin, liber, free. Webster's Ninth New Collegiate Dictionary, 1983 to 1990. Liberal. Liberalis. Suitable for a free man. Generous. Liber. Free. Akin to oin loden, to grow. Eleutherus, free. One. Of, relating to, or based on liberal arts, education. B. Archaic. Of or befitting a free man, or free by birth. Two. Generous, open-handed. B. Given or provided in a generous and open-handed way. C. Ample, full. 3. Obsolete, lacking moral restraint, licentious. 4. not literal or strict, loose, a loose translation. 5. Broad-minded, especially not bound by authoritarianism, orthodoxy, or traditional forms. 6. A. Of favoring or based upon the principles of liberalism. B. Of or constituting a political party, advocating or associating with the political or with the principles of political liberalism. Of or constituting a political party in the United Kingdom associated with the ideas of individuals, especially economic freedom, greater individual participation in government, and constitutional, political, and administration reforms designed to secure these objectives. Liberally. Synonyms. Liberal. Generous. Bountiful. Munificent. Giving freely. And unstintingly. Liberal suggestions, open-handedness in giving in the giver, and largely in the thing or amount given. Generous. Stresses warm-hearted and readiness to give more than size or importance of the gift. Bountiful. Suggest lavish, unremitting, giving or providing munificent. Suggests a scale of giving appropriate to lords of princes. 2. Liberal, 1816. One who is liberal, one who is open-minded, or not strict in the observance of orthodox, traditional, or established forms or ways. B. A member or supporter of a liberal party. An advocate or adherent of liberalism, especially individual rights. The Oxford English Dictionary, OED, 2nd edition, 1989. Liberal. 1. Originally the distinctive epithet of those arts or sciences that were considered worthy of a free man, opposed to servile or mechanical. In later use, of conditioned pursuits occupants, pertaining to or suitable to persons or superior social station, becoming a gentleman. Now rare, except of education, culture, etc., with mixture of senses, 3 and 4, directed to the general intellectual enlargement and refinement. Not narrowly restricted to the requirements of technical or professional training, frequently in liberal arts. 2. Free in bestowing, bountiful, generous, open-hearted, consistent of a gift, offer, etc., made without stint, of a meal, an entertainment, etc., also of a fortune. Abundant, ample. C. Hence occasionally of outline, parts of the body, etc., ample, large. 3. A. Free from restraint. Free in speech or action. In the 16th and 17th centuries, often in a bad sense. Unrestrained by prudence or decorum, licentious. Literal arbiter. Free will. Obsolete. B. Of passage, etc. Freely permitted, not interfered with. Obsolete, except archaic. C. Of construction or interpretation, inclining to laxity or indulgence, not rigorous. Also of translation, free, not literal. D. With agent noun that does something freely or copiously. 4. A. Free from narrow prejudice, open-minded, candid. B. Especially free from bigotry or unreasonable prejudice in favor of traditional opinions or established institutions, open to the reception of new ideas or proposals of reform. Hence often applied to a party designation to those members of a church or religious sect who hold opinions broader or more advanced than those in accordance with its commonly accepted standard of orthodoxy. For example, liberal Catholic, liberal Christian. In the U.S. chiefly applied to Unitarians and Universalists. In England, somewhat vaguely to those who reject or consider unessential any considerable part of the traditional system of belief, so liberal Christianity, liberal theology, also an application to Judaism. 5. Of political opinions, favorable to constitutional changes and legal or administration reforms tending in the direction of freedom or democracy, hence used as the designation of the party holding such opinions, in England or other states, opposed to conservative. Liberal Labor, of or pertaining to persons associated with or sympathetic to both the Liberal and the Labor parties. So liberal laborism. In liberal conservative, the adjective has rather sense for than this sense. The combination, however, is often hyphened, which perhaps indicates that it is interpreted as partly liberal, partly conservative. Liberal unionist. A member of the party formed by those liberals who refused to support Mr. Gladstone's measure of the Irish Home Rule in 1886. 6. Combined as linguistic archaic, Burgoy's cultural, democratic, empiricist, hearted, humanist, minded, scientific, liberal anarchism, mindedness. B. 1. A member of the Liberal Party. A. In constitutional politics. B. In British politics. Early in the 19th century, the noun occurs chiefly as applied to opponents of the advanced section of the Whig Party, sometimes in Spain or France, from application with the intention of suggesting that the principles of those politicians were un-English or akin to those of revolutionaries of the continent. As, however, the adjective was already English in the laudatory sense, the advocates of reform were not reluctant to adopt the foreign term as the descriptive of themselves, and when the significance of the old party distinctions was obliterated by the coalition of the moderate Whigs with the Tories and of the advance Whigs with the Radicals, the new names Liberal and Conservative took the place of Whig and Tory, as in the usual appellations of the two parties in the state. An extra-European politics and wider application. 2. One who holds liberal views in theology, chiefly U.S. Webster's Encyclopedic Unabridged Dictionary of the English Language, 1996, and this is the Random House edition. Liberal. 1. Favorable to progress or reform, as in political or religious affairs. 2. Often noting or pertaining to a political party advocating measures of progressive political reform. 3. Of, pertaining to, based on, or advocating liberalism. 4. Favorable to or in accord with concepts of maximum individual freedom possible, especially as guaranteed by law and secured by governmental protection of civil liberties. 5. Favoring of permitting freedom of action, especially with respect to matters of personal belief or expression, a liberal policy toward dissident artists and writers. 6. Of or pertaining to representational forms of government rather than aristocracies and monarchies. 7. Free from prejudice or bigotry, tolerant, a liberal attitude toward foreigners. 8. Open-minded or tolerant, especially free of or not bound by traditional or conventional ideas, values, etc. 9. Characterized by generosity and willingness to give in large amounts, a liberal donor. 10. Given freely or abundantly, generous, a liberal donation. 11. Not strict or rigorous, free, not literal, a liberal interpretation of a rule. 12. Of, pertaining to, or based on the liberal arts. 13. Of, or pertaining to, or befitting a free man. 14. A person of liberal principles or views, especially in politics or religion. 15. A member of a liberal party in politics, especially of the Liberal Party in Great Britain. Of freedom, befitting the free. Equivalent to liber, free. Synonyms: progressive, broad-minded, unprejudiced, beneficent, charitable, open-handed, munificent, unstinting, lavish, see generous, see ample. It is obvious by going back 150 years that the word liberal has not changed one iota. In fact, the 1996 definition is closer to the 1893 definition than to the 1983-1990 definition. As we can see, liberal ideology founded the very idea behind our nation's ideology. Freedom. Fun with antonyms. If you're not liberal, what are you? By definition, using antonyms, you are uneducated, unintellectual, closed of heart, selfish, narrow, contracted, mean, small, fascist, racist, bigoted, homophobic, stingy, closed-minded, supportive of monarchies and slavery, against freedom of religion, expression, and speech, low in birth and mind, anti-American. If you've been out bashing liberals, you're probably all of these things, as this would perfectly describe someone who would go out liberal bashing, i.e. freedom bashing, which is also known as liberticide, the destruction of civil liberties. Webster's International Dictionary, 1893. Liber, as in liberal, is also the root word of liberty, freedom from restraint. Libertarian, one who holds free will. Libertine, a freed man. Liberalism, the principles of liberals. Liberalist, one who is a liberal or who favors principles of liberals. Liberalized, freed from narrow views and prejudices. Liberate, to make free, and several others. Liber is Latin for free. In fact, the root word liber is also the Latin word for book. This is because many ancient philosophies believed that you could only free your mind through education and reading by learning the Logos, thought to be the written word of God. Where you freed your mind was in the universities and or libraries, which held the books. If we believe the stories told to us by our high school history books, then liberal is what this country's forefathers were and wanted. Let's not forget that the immigrant pilgrims who came to the New World, now called America, from Europe were coming here to get away from the monarchist and Catholic Inquisition control over religion, speech, white slavery, and the use of plants for medicine and drugs, witches and pagans, etc., as we are told they were liberals trying to break through the monarchist control of England and the church to create political and religious reform and tolerance. And on a side note, in actuality, many wanted their own religious freedom away from the Catholic or Protestant control of religion, but did not want to give freedom to those whose lands in the New World they stole, nor their own kind who use the herbs, etc., to heal themselves, i.e. the Salem witch trials, Native American shamanism, etc. Sound familiar? Next time before you go blame those damn liberals, you'd better take a look in the dictionary. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic, not democracy, for which it stands, one nation under God, illegal under separation of church and state, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Separation of church and state means that God does not bless America or any land over any other land. We have this protection for the carnage that the churches have caused throughout history, hence the First Amendment. The definition of leftist. And because liberal is nearly always associated with the left or leftists, here is the definition of a leftist. Leftist. Noun. 1. A member of the political left or a person sympathetic to its views. Adjective. 2. Of, pertaining to, characteristic of, or advocating by the political left. Also, leftist. That's it. That's the entire definition. Now, how about the definition of conservative? Now, you're probably wondering what the definition of conservative is, right? So now let's see if our forefathers wanted to conserve England's monarchist control. Conservative, adjective, 1. Disposed to preserve existing conditions, institutions, etc., or to restore traditional ones and to limit change. 2. Cautiously moderate or purposefully low, a conservative estimate. 3. Traditional in style or manner, avoiding novelty or showiness, conservative suit. 4. Often of or pertaining to the Conservative Party. 5. Of, pertaining to, or characteristic of the Conservative Jews or Conservative Judaism. 6. Having the power or tendency to conserve, preservative. 7. Math, of a vector or vector function, having curl equal to 0, irrotational, lamellar. Noun. 8. A person who is conservative in principles and actions, habits, etc. 9. A supporter of conservative political parties. 10. A member of conservative political party, especially the Conservative Party in Great Britain. 11. A preservative. So here I ask, where does the definition of conservative mention freedom? As it says in entry number 5 of the Oxford English Dictionary's 1989 definition of liberal above, quote, favorable to constitutional changes and legal or administrative reforms tending in the direction of freedom or democracy. Hence used as the designation of the party holding such opinions in England or other states, opposed to conservative. That's right. True conservatives, by their very definition, are opposed to freedom. But they don't want you to think so. So they've lied by changing the very meaning of the word, thereby manipulating others into thinking that they want to join up with this conservative suppression of freedom and democracy, liberticide, as if they have something in common with the wealthy elite of the world. Who but the aristocracies of the world would design such a scam? If the stories are correct, were our forefathers trying to conserve England's monarchy? Were they trying to limit change, avoid novelty, progress, and freedom? Or were they promoting ultimate personal freedom of religion, speech, choice, liberty? If you say you promote conservative points of view for America, then you cannot forget to ask whose conservative points of view you're promoting. Are you promoting just Christian, Buddhist, Muslim, Jewish, or Native American views? What about homophobic or bigoted views? Pro-life, pro-choice views, or are you promoting the view to each his or her own? In America, all of these views must work together to have liberty. Isn't that what America and liberty are supposed to be about? To think and believe your own? To seek happiness? To seek the ultimate freedom? And yes, to alter your state of consciousness if that is your belief? To control the destiny of your own mind and body without fear is true liberty. Life, liberty, and freedom in the pursuit of happiness. What happened to the word liberal? If it's not the liberals, then who is it? The word liberal's meaning has been twisted by those in power to mean that if you are a liberal, you are against freedom. With this tactic, when you want to support and be pro-freedom, you will think that those who are taking your freedom away are actually protecting it, the corporations. And likewise, those who are pro-freedom, the liberals, you will think are against freedom. It's the old switcheroo. And let me be clear that I don't define Democrats or Republicans as liberal. Both are pro-corporation or pro-fascist. In fact, Clinton and Bush both bashed the liberal media. Liberal is better defined by the libertarian, one who holds free will, or green parties. The question as to what happened to the word liberal and the way that it is incorrectly being used in politics, news, and in the corporate media can be explained like this. It is basically a word used by those who are taking our freedom, liberticide, to take attention away from themselves. The corporate media talking about liberals taking your freedom away is in and of itself an illogical statement. Liberals are pro-freedom by their very definition. In fact, in contrast, corporate media cannot be liberal. By definition, corporate media is fascist, and fascist is what the Nazis were, pro-corporation, not free. Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it is the merger of state and corporate power. Benito Mussolini, Italian fascist dictator and prime minister, 1922 to 1943, who conducted an expansionist foreign policy, formalized an alliance with Germany in 1939, and brought Italy into World War II in 1940. Dismissed by Victor Emmanuel III in 1943, he led a puppet Nazi government in northern Italy until 1945, when he was assassinated. What the common person generally means to do or say when they bash the liberal media or people is to bash the fascist, i.e. Nazi-controlled, manipulated, uninquisitive, i.e. conservative, self-interested, and mostly made of lies, corporate media. Rush Limbaugh, a pro-corporate equals pro-fascist talk show host, will blame the liberal-dominated media all day long. Rush Limbaugh is nationally syndicated on corporate radio and TV. Rush is broadcast on the very media he calls liberal, where he supposedly can't get a word in edgewise. Rather illogical, don't you think? With up to 6 hours a day of broadcast time in certain areas, I hardly believe that Rush is having trouble sharing his conservative, liberal, freedom-bashing, fascist, pro-corporate opinions in the corporate media whose views he supports. Rush is in control of the very liberal, actually corporate fascist, media he complains about. Rush is his own liberal or freedom problem. He is the one he seeks to blame, those taking his freedom, the fascists, the corporations, the corporate media, himself. Note once again that both Clinton and Bush bash the liberal media. How about having Michael Parenti on, or Noam Chomsky, or Gore Vidal, or Howard Zinn? Or how about people like us, people like this show? If the media were truly free or liberal, you would hear much more from people like these, people like yourself, and more from the laborers and from the people themselves, such as on Pacifica Network Radio. You would hear much less from the fascist corporations and those in controlling power. This would be free, liberal, or people's radio and TV. Public radio such as Pacifica Network is funded by its listeners, and they do not accept any money from businesses or corporations. And I should note, every hour of NPR and PBS is sponsored and underwritten by large corporations such as Chevron. These outlets are not liberal or free. Most of the so-called liberal media is owned by five corporations, most of which have many of the same stockholders. Several of these five corporations are controlled by arms manufacturers or stockholders of arms manufacturers like the Carlyle Group, General Electric, and Westinghouse. Corporate media is interested in one thing and one thing only, profit, to pay the stockholders. Corporate media is not necessarily interested in the truth or the hottest story, but what will sell airtime and profit the corporation most. If we are in a time of war, then it is in General Electric's best interest to promote the war, as they own NBC. It behooves them to be pro-war, to sell weapons, to make a profit, not to tell you the full story or the truth. Anyone who has ever listened to Pacifica Network and their affiliate radio stations, which are 100% corporate free, knows exactly what I'm talking about. Pacifica Network is the only truly corporate-free or liberal news network in the entire country. If you've never listened to Pacifica Radio, then you've never even heard liberal media. If you've never heard liberal media, then how can you blame the liberal media? Let's once and for all end this pathetic, uneducated use of the word liberal and this attack on freedom by those who claim to support it.
When you cast your eyes upon the skylines of this once proud nation, can you sense the fear and the hatred growing in the hearts of its population? And our youth, oh youth, are being seduced by the greedy hands of politics and half-truths. The beaten generation, the beaten generation, reared up.
by the gasoline fumes and hypnotized by the satellites into believing what is good and what is right. You may be worshipping the temples of mammon or lost in the prisons of religion, but can you still walk back to happiness when you've nowhere left to run? The beaten generation, the beaten generation, reared on a diet of prejudice and misinformation. The beaten generation, the beaten generation, open your eyes.
Is Guns and Butter.
And it's interesting to note that they're not killing civilians in a sporadic fashion. They're killing civilians in universities, schools, hospitals, these are the areas which are being targeted. They're targeting the institutions of civil society. They're destroying the institutional base, the resources, and the people. And that is the way in which you destroy a country.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chosadovsky. Today's show, The Invasion of Gaza. Michelle Chosadovsky is a professor of economics and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. The Center for Research on Globalization is an independent research and media group of writers, scholars, and activists. Based in Montreal, the global research website at www.globalresearch.ca publishes news articles, commentary, background research, and analysis on a broad range of issues focusing on social, economic, strategic, geopolitical, and environmental processes. Chosadovsky is the author of The Globalization of Poverty, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, and America's War on Terrorism, as well as numerous articles. Today we focus on two of his most recent articles, The Invasion of Gaza, Operation Cast Lead, Part of a Broader Israeli Military Intelligence Agenda, and War and Natural Gas, the Israeli invasion and Gaza's offshore gas fields. Michelle Chosadovsky, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be on the program.
Michelle, you've written a new article on Israel-Palestine, The Invasion of Gaza, Operation Cast Lead, Part of a Broader Israeli Military Intelligence Agenda. When did Israel begin to plan for the operation they call Operation Cast Lead?
Well, in fact, this operation is part of a much broader operation which was initiated in 2001. It was, in fact, a project of Ariel Sharon and his national security advisor, Meir Dagan, who actually now has become the director of Israeli intelligence, Mossad. Essentially, that earlier plan in 2001 was entitled Operation Justified Vengeance. It was formulated during the election campaign in the year 2000. And when Ariel Sharon became prime minister, it was presented to the Israeli cabinet as a plan, essentially a plan of destabilization as well as invasion of the Palestinian territories, using the pretext of civilian deaths to undertake major military operations, so that the suicide bombings were in fact, they were in fact expected, and military operations were timed to coincide with those suicide bombings, so that civilian casualties on both the Israeli and the Palestinian side were there to justify a process of escalation. So that we had this operation, the operation actually was called Justified Vengeance, so it was retaliation, but in effect it was a plan which consisted essentially in destroying the whole foundations of the Palestinian Authority, its military and security capabilities, its institutions. And one aspect of this plan, as I said, it was also called the Dagan Plan, named after Mayor Dagan, was the idea that the West Bank and Gaza would be virtually cut off from one another. It was called in one report, it was described as cantonization. In other words, well, essentially Balkanization of the two major Palestinian territories, to the extent that they wouldn't be able to have an integrated political and institutional apparatus. They'd be cut off. They would also, of course, create conditions where they couldn't communicate between these two territories. And if we look at the rhetoric behind this this plan, because it wasn't extensively reported, but it was covered by Jane, which is the major military analysis magazine based in Britain, and various other Israeli reports. But if we look at what's happening now, we can see very clearly the relationship. For instance, at the outset of this document, 2001 document, it states that that the Dagan plan calls for, quote, an invasion of Palestinian-controlled territory by some 30,000 Israeli soldiers, with the clearly defined mission of destroying the infrastructure of the Palestinian leadership and collecting weaponry currently possessed by the various Palestinian forces and expelling or killing its military leadership. That is a quote from a review of this military operation, Operation Justified Vengeance, which was published in 2001. So that we can see that in fact we're not dealing with something which is a short-term occurrence. It's part of a broader plan. I view it as a plan which very specifically and deliberately is geared towards the expulsion of Palestinians, the exodus or the deportation of tens of thousands of people, where life is made virtually impossible through the destruction of schools, workplaces, hospitals, and then this will eventually encourage people to emigrate and will weaken their resistance to Israeli attacks.
Now, this plan that you're referring to of Ariel Sharon that dates back to 2001. Tanya Reinhart wrote of this, didn't she? And then she died unexpectedly after leaving Israel?
Well, that's correct. Tanya Reinhart was one of the major analysts of these various operations. I mean, she had a tremendous understanding of the whole historical process. And when I wrote this article, I based it in part on some of her earlier writings, because she was familiar with this operation, and she was familiar with the whole sequence of operations. The important thing here is to understand that there were several stages, and the interlock stages. First of all, there was the question of the assassination of Yasser Arafat. That was in November 2004. Okay?
Well, that's right. I mean, that was actually stated almost publicly, wasn't it, that that was the Israeli intent to assassinate Arafat?
Absolutely. It was a project of the Israeli cabinet. They don't even deny the fact that this assassination was planned well in advance. Tanya Reinhart reviews it. The assassination was in 2004, but in fact, going back even to the 90s, there was a secret plan to assassinate Yasser Arafat. But what I think is revealing is that in 2003, the Israeli cabinet stated quite openly that their objective was to assassinate Yasser Arafat. And we then recall that there was a United Nations Security Council resolution condemning the Israeli cabinet decision to assassinate Yasser Arafat, which was opposed by which was in fact vetoed by the United States. Okay, the United Nations stands up for fundamental international law and human rights and condemns the a decision of a foreign government to assassinate Yasser Arafat. Namely, the Israeli government decides quite openly that they're going to kill him. And then the United States says, no, we veto that resolution which condemns political assassination. It should come as no surprise, because the United States also has a policy of political assassinations. So, we recall that when Arafat died the following year in 2004, nobody really remembered in our distinguished mainstream media that the order had been given to assassinate him. And they then concocted various explanations of his death. I mean, there was some discussion of the assassination, but it was not carried through in any meaningful way by the mainstream media, and nobody really seemed to be concerned as to who had actually ordered the assassination of Yasser Arafat. I suspect that this was an order emanating from, of course, from the government, and it was carried out by Israeli intelligence, and which at that time was headed by Meir Dagan. So there we have it. I think there's several events which are very important in analyzing Gaza. One is, of course, the assassination of Arafat.
Michelle, before you go on to the other points, why, in your opinion, did the Israelis want to remove Arafat?
Well, that's precisely what I want to focus on. Yasser Arafat was essentially... he was a tremendously popular figure. Okay, he was ambiguous in his positions and so on, but he had popular support, and I think it was understood that if Yasser Arafat were to be assassinated, the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian movement would. Become increasingly divided, and that's exactly what happened. Once Arafat had been assassinated, they then appointed their own proxy, which was Mahmoud Abbas, to succeed Arafat. Mahmoud Abbas, it's well known, is an instrument of both Israel and the United States. Yasser Arafat, up to a point, was also manipulated by the United States, but again, he was an important figure in the whole struggle and background. But in any event, this assassination, I think, served to initiate a process of destabilization of the Palestinian Authority, because on the one hand, it led to divisions within the movement, and secondly, it led to the election victory of Hamas in 2006, which would not have been possible had Arafat been around. I believe that was part of it, is that the assassination of Arafat led the way, set the stage for the victory of Hamas. And I firmly believe that this victory of Hamas was something which also had been foreseen and, in a sense, planned by Israel. We must remember that Hamas, going back to its beginnings, was actually supported covertly by Israel, because they saw in Hamas the possibility of undermining the civilian secular administration, so that Hamas was supported by funds from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, and Israel was also supporting the movement covertly with a view to weakening Fatah and the Palestinian Authority. I think that they foresaw the outcome of this election and the fact that the election would provide the opportunity to ultimately destabilize the Palestinian Authority altogether, destroy the political fabric of Palestine, and they would then, of course, use the pretext of the Hamas government, allegedly an Islamic terrorist organization, to virtually pursue the subsequent stages in this Operation Justified Vengeance.
I'm speaking with economist and author Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The Invasion of Gaza. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
So that I believe that the election of Hamas was something which was, in essence, was staged, because it took place following the death of Arafat and the creation of divisions within the Fatah movement. And it also occurred, and that's very important, it occurred after the evacuation also of Jewish settlements in Gaza. Now, that was also a very important occurrence, and it was also misunderstood by virtually everybody. When in 2005, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon ordered the removal of all Jewish settlements inside Gaza, and we're talking about a population of over 7,000. And this population was relocated. Now, Sharon was not doing this to please the Palestinians. In fact, the Palestinians said, oh, this is a great victory for us. Now we control our lands. And then Washington was saying, well, this is part of the roadmap to peace. But in effect, what it really was, It was part of the project of the Israeli government to create a concentration camp, a barricaded prison territory in the Gaza Strip, which would not have been possible had there been Jewish settlers inside the Gaza Strip. So, in effect, that removal on the orders of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon of all Jewish settlements in Gaza was part of a plan to ultimately barricade Gaza, transform it into a concentration camp. Some people have made the analogy between Gaza and the Warsaw Ghetto, and there certainly is an analogy to be made. because essentially you're enclosing people, you're not letting them go out, and then you start to starve them to death, you block the supplies of food and medical assistance and so on, and that is precisely what they're doing now. They have made life virtually impossible for the Gazan population. They're killing men, women, and children, and this would not have been, as I say, possible had there been 7,000 Jewish settlers inside the Gazan territory.
Well, right, and also the removal of the Jewish settlements in Gaza under Sharon in 2005, that had to be a prelude to an attack on Gaza. They could hardly attack Gaza if there were Jewish settlements there, right?
Absolutely. This operation would not have been possible had they not removed those settlements. And the political fabric of Palestine would not have been the same had Yasser Arafat still been around. So that the objective of Operation Justified Vengeance was essentially to transform Palestine into territories without any kind of political authority, destroy its institutions, and as far as Gaza is concerned, to transform Gaza into a prison which is barricaded by the Israeli, you know, the Israeli security guards, and virtually it's a barricaded prison territory. So I think that was definitely part of that plan, Operation Justified Vengeance.
Well, Michel, with regard to what's happening right now, Operation Cast Lead, and this is the attack on Gaza, wasn't this exactly when Israel was beginning to negotiate a ceasefire agreement with Hamas that the plans for the present operation were made?
Well, precisely. The Operation Cast Lead was planned essentially in, I would say, around June of last year. In other words, June 2008. And that was precisely at the time when they had reached a ceasefire agreement with Hamas. Now, I think there are two things which are important. One is the fact that they actually planned this operation very carefully at the outset of a ceasefire arrangement. So obviously they had the subsequent objective to violate that ceasefire in the form of a major military operation. But as we read in the mainstream media, the Katyushka rocket attacks on Israel by Hamas have always been used as the pretext to justify this military operation. But in fact, there were no rocket attacks by Hamas until Israel broke the ceasefire on November 4th, 2008, the very same day we had U.S. presidential elections, and of course everybody had their eyes somewhere else, so that on that same day, Israel breaks the ceasefire. They chose their day, and they killed quite a number of Hamas militants, allegedly because they were building a tunnel, and so the ceasefire was broken. And the ceasefire was broken quite deliberately by Israel. And this is now acknowledged, but at the same time, I say it's acknowledged by the mainstream media because they never mentioned it initially, but then they've dismissed it. They're saying, well, Hamas are digging tunnels, so we had the right to go in and bomb them. But it's also important to mention that on November the 5th, one day after they broke the ceasefire, they launched a siege of Gaza, cutting off food, fuel, medical supplies. And so if anybody wants to really analyze who broke the ceasefire, obviously Israel broke the ceasefire. and they had planned to break the ceasefire, and they had planned to break the ceasefire on November 4th, at the very moment the United States was voting for a new president. And so that operation, Cast Lead, is part of the broader operation of destroying Palestine. Eventually, I think that they want to expulse the Palestinians. Whether that will occur, that's another matter, because, again, the Palestinians have been struggling for their lands for more than half a century, and I think that they have a tremendous courage and resilience and capacity to fight for their rights. But I think the long-term plan by Israel is expulsion. And that territory, Gaza, is very important to them because it has very significant offshore gas reserves. In other words, they're offshore gas fields which represent billions of dollars of revenue. The sovereignty over those gas fields belongs to Palestine. I mean, the gas fields belong to Palestine. In other words, it's within their jurisdiction. And I think that Israel essentially wants to take over those gas fields, which are off the coast of Gaza.
Well, you've written another article that I should mention on the Israel-Palestine situation called War and Natural Gas, the Israeli Invasion and Gaza's Offshore Gas Fields. Now, these gas fields were discovered in 2000, isn't that right?
Yes, the actual, well, there were probably prior to 2000, there was exploration and so on, but the actual discovery was in 2000. It was a project of the Palestinian Authority at the time under Yasser Arafat, and there was an agreement with British Gas, which is a very large company. It's now called the BG Group, the British Gas Group. So British Gas signed an agreement actually in 1999 with the Palestinian Authority, and it was granted oil and gas exploration rights for a 25-year period. And this was essentially a contract between three partners, British Gas, Consolidated Contractors, which is a Lebanese company which is based in Greece, and the Palestinian Authority. And so the Palestinian Authority not only was the shareholder of this project, but it would also be receiving royalties from the production of this gas. So essentially, if the gas were to be marketed and sold, then the Palestinian Authority, the investment fund of the Palestinian Authority, would be getting revenues from this. What has happened, there again we have to look at history, because right from the outset of Ariel Sharon's government in 2001, the sovereignty of these gas fields by Palestine, Palestine sovereignty or ownership of these gas fields, has been questioned by the government of Ariel Sharon. At one point, the ownership of these offshore gas fields was challenged by the Israeli Supreme Court. Sharon stated unequivocally that Israel would not buy gas from Palestine, intimating that, in fact, these offshore reserves belong to Israel. And on the other hand, what was happening is that the Israeli government was negotiating behind the scenes with British Gas, and British Gas was playing a double game. It was talking to the Palestinians, negotiating with the Palestinians, and then it was negotiating with the Israelis. And essentially, how this thing evolved is very important, because Israel decided in, well, it decided essentially in 2006 to start negotiating directly with British Gas. And the objective was really to reach a deal whereby the gas from Gaza would be channeled by pipeline to the Israeli port of Ashkelon, and then it could be channeled for essentially domestic consumption. And they negotiated with British Gas in 2006, and again in the subsequent year, the negotiations fell flat because essentially the Israelis insisted that the Hamas government and the Palestinian Authority would not get any royalties. That was really, Israel didn't own these concessions. They weren't party to the agreement with British Gas, but yet they had appointed negotiators. The Israeli cabinet appointed negotiators which entered into discussions with British Gas, and they said, we will reach an agreement with you as long as the Palestinians don't get any money. And then they said that the Palestinians should be paid in goods and services, and insisted that no money should go to the Hamas-controlled government. That was a statement of Israeli defense authorities. So that there what you saw emerging was an attempt by the Israeli government, in cahoots with British Gas, essentially, to nullify the contract signed in 1999 between the BG Group and the Palestinian Authority, at that time under Yasser Arafat, which gave the license to British Gas, but at the same time, where the whole contract would still be under the political authority of the Palestinians, and where the revenues would be shared according to that initial agreement. And really what the Israelis wanted to do in these negotiations was to bypass Hamas on the grounds that Hamas was an Islamic government, okay? Not to recognize that Hamas's legitimacy as a government, as an elected government, and then use that as a pretext to renegotiate this multi-billion-dollar contract signed in 1999, which would then allow them to virtually become de facto owners of those offshore gas reserves. And I suspect that that is part of the current agenda, is that the invasion plan, which in effect has been on the drawing board for several years. It was formulated in its active stage in June of 2008. But in effect, this invasion plan of Gaza has been envisaged for quite some time. And I think the objective is ultimately to redefine the territory, and eventually also, in the process of redefining the territory, also of establishing a new regime for the Palestinian gas fields. I suspect that we're going to see an attempt on the part of Israel to confiscate those gas fields and declare sovereignty over Gaza's maritime areas. As to whether that will succeed is another matter, but that, I think, is one of the objectives of this invasion.
I'm speaking with economist and author Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The Invasion of Gaza. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
This is a very important and strategic coastline because it has extensive gas reserves. British Gas estimates it at $3 billion, something like $3 to $4 billion worth. But it could be much larger. They don't normally reveal the actual size of those reserves in their public declarations. And if we look at the coastline extending from Syria down to Egypt, it's an area of tremendous wealth as far as the offshore gas reserves.
Michelle, could you describe the energy corridor that runs all the way from Turkey down to Egypt, that coastal corridor? How does that work with regard to energy supplies?
Well, that's another aspect of energy geopolitics, is that, first of all, there's a project, a major oil and gas pipeline, which links the Caspian Sea to the eastern Mediterranean. It's called the Baku-Tbilisi-Seyan pipeline. It runs from the Caspian Sea port of Baku, which is the capital of Azerbaijan, through Georgia, the capital of Georgia, and then it goes right down to the eastern Mediterranean, and it bypasses Russian territory. It's a consortium controlled by British Petroleum. It's called the BTC, the pipeline. And where this Caspian Sea pipeline becomes important is that Israel is in the process of negotiating for a couple of years now a project with Turkey which would link the BTC pipeline to its main pipeline, which runs from Ashkelon right down to the Red Sea port of Eilat. But in effect, I believe that this pipeline would in effect integrate also the northern part of Israel, in other words, the port of Haifa. What is important to bear in mind is the fact that if these two pipelines are integrated, this would mean that Caspian Sea oil and gas would run from the Azeri port of Baku on the Caspian Sea right down to Israel, down to the port of Eilat on the Red Sea, where it can then be exported back to Asia. It sounds incredible, but I understand that Israel and Turkey have signed that agreement. Initially, that was before the war in Lebanon. They had pointed to the fact that they would be doing this in terms of an underwater pipeline in the eastern Mediterranean. But I think the longer term objective is, in fact, to militarize that entire coastline extending from Turkey down through Syria and Lebanon, and of course the Gaza Strip as well, and eventually you'd have a corridor, a transport corridor, right up to right from the Red Sea up to the eastern Mediterranean, which would then link up with the BTC pipeline. One really has to look at a map to see the intricacies of this. But what this means is that Israel is going to play a very major role, because that's really a hub there in the eastern Mediterranean. It's going to play a very major role in protecting these pipeline corridors out of the Caspian Sea. I should mention that Israel and Turkey have a long-standing military and intelligence cooperation agreement. It's a very tightly knit relationship. Turkey is of course a member of NATO. It has one of the largest capabilities of NATO member countries, if we exclude, let's say, Britain, France, and Germany. But Turkey is a backbone of NATO in terms of conventional forces, and it has various agreements with Israel on intelligence sharing, military training, so-called defense production, in other words, the production of weaponry, and so on, exchange of technology. And so if you look, again, if one looks at the map, one understands very clearly why there is an agreement with Turkey. The agreement with Turkey is really to establish the control by Israel of that eastern Mediterranean coastline. The corridor is oil and gas on the one hand, but it's also water. It's water from Anatolia. It's also water from the from Mesopotamia, and so that essentially, I believe that that whole coastline extending up to Syria is a target for future military operations. The objective is to militarize that coastline. It's interesting to note that in a map which has been used for military training by the U.S. War Academy as well as by NATO, the Syrian coastline is identified as a separate entity. It's in a sense, it's sort of annexed to Lebanon, so that Syria becomes landlocked and that whole coastline becomes a separate territory. I think that that is the objective. I'm not suggesting that this will necessarily occur, but Israel has certain territorial objectives. It wants to gain political control over Gaza to the extent that these gas reserves are completely under its jurisdiction. It wants to militarize the coastline so that it can control the oil and gas pipelines which link up with Turkey and the Baku Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline. So that is the underlying context of, and that's, I think, important when we assess what's happening in Gaza. We're very much, of course, concerned about the humanitarian crisis, but at the same time, it's very important that we understand that there are strategic and economic objectives behind those killings.
Well, with regard to this present attack on Gaza, a massacre, really, Operation Cast Lead, what about the separation of Gaza from the West Bank and then now the breaking apart of Gaza itself? I understand that the Israeli military is dividing Gaza into two parts.
Well, there have been some reports on that division. It's not entirely clear. I think they're cutting off... Gaza City from other parts of the territory, but I'm not sure whether that is. I don't think that that's part of the longer term plan of subdividing the territory. It's more of a, it has to do with the military operation per se. So it's not entirely clear right now. As to how they will reorganize the territory, the Gaza Strip, once this military operation is completed, and whether they'll be able to, but I think that their objective is to militarize the coastline.
And then you've also mentioned perhaps another ultimate objective of Operation Cast Lead ultimately would be expulsion, I guess.
Absolutely. I think that that is already occurring. You see, for instance, Egypt, until Egypt has kept the border closed, and I'm sure that they are collaborating with the Israelis on that. And at one point, I think that that border is going to open up, and then you're going to get tens of thousands of people moving out. But the question is, where do they go? Because if they don't have, if there's no possibility of giving them refuge in Egypt, they're going to be completely destitute, and we're going to have a situation which could be comparable to that of Central Africa. They're already refugees, so they're fleeing. Where would they flee to? So I think that this is a genocide. They may open the borders, but that doesn't mean necessarily that people will be able to flee to rebuild their lives somewhere else, particularly with a hostile environment in Egypt.
I'm speaking with economist and author Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, The Invasion of Gaza. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Michel, what do you know about the new type of weaponry that the Israelis are employing? I've read about something called dense inert metal explosive that involves some sort of a tungsten alloy, and that, of course, we're hearing daily reports about severe amputations of people who are hit by these things.
Yeah, well, I've read the reports. I should mention that the weapons that they're using, I suspect, are the same ones that they used in the campaign in Lebanon, where for the first time there were certain types of weapons which had very unusual impacts in terms of the types of wounds that people were suffering, the burns, etc. A pretty awful situation. That was documented, actually. I recall that it was documented by an Italian medical team in Lebanon, and I suspect that these new and unknown deadly weapons used in Lebanon in July 2006 are the same as the ones that were used in Gaza. The descriptions, I mean, the reports at the time were so-called direct energy weapons, and also using chemical and biological agents. The bodies, there were macabre reports of civilians with damage to lower limbs which required amputation. That we're getting those reports again, and there's also the issue of the white phosphorus bombs, which are essentially used to burn vast areas. I mean, people would be, I presume, would be burned alive in those types of, with those types of weapons. Yes, those are weapons used. When I mentioned Lebanon, because in fact we had a lot more information on Lebanon because of the fact that there were more, there were many non-governmental organizations which were there. We had medical teams, and in Gaza we don't. We don't have that kind of, that ability to examine what's actually going on in the conflict area.
Well then, would you say that the main objective of Operation Cast Lead is to terrorize the civilians and get them to leave, because the attacks are obviously being made, you know, on civilians?
Yeah, these are attacks on civilians, and I think that the attacks on civilians essentially is there to create those conditions. It's to preclude the possibility that people can actually organize themselves in the form of a country or a political entity. And the way to do that is to kill people, because then all the capabilities of the, you know, of the society are destroyed. I mean, in Iraq, the United States occupation forces, through their various paramilitaries, were involved in targeted assassinations directed against scientists, engineers, intellectuals, professionals. Essentially, it was to destroy the human resources of the country, to foreclose the possibility that that country could rebuild itself and remain as a country, and then you destroy the historical memory and so on. I think they're doing it, well, that it's much more advanced in Palestine than in Iraq, but that is the way in which you destroy a nation. And it's interesting to note that they're not killing civilians in a sporadic fashion. They're killing civilians in universities, schools, hospitals. These are the areas which are being targeted. They're targeting the institutions of civil society. They're destroying the institutional base, the resources, and the people. And that is the way in which you destroy a country. I assume that they're also trying to dismantle the security and military capabilities of Hamas, because they still have to fight an urban warfare once they get there. So that is another factor. But it's interesting to note that you have this targeted bombings of civilian infrastructure. It's nothing new. They did it in Yugoslavia. The NATO and the United States bombed. They systematically bombed hospitals, schools, churches in Yugoslavia. In the year 2000, I was in Belgrade, and I actually visited the children's hospital there, and it was just incredible to see how, with these smart bombs, they managed to hit the power generation of the hospital, which then virtually meant that all the children had to be evacuated because they didn't have any electricity. Okay, so that's the kind of thing that they do. Also in Yugoslavia, they bombed the petrochemical plant, and they did it in such a way that they would hit the containers which had toxic chemicals, and they used thermal detection to do it. Okay. So these techniques are being applied. It's war to the nth degree. It is the killing of civilians, and it's the destruction of the civilian economy, of manufacturing, of agriculture. It's the contamination of water, the destruction of sewage systems, and so on. So there we are.
You end your article on Operation Cast Lead saying, "The broader question is whether Israel, in consultation with Washington, is intent upon triggering a wider war."
Well, that is, of course, something which has been of concern to us for quite some time. The fact is that this kind of operation could easily escalate. We already see that there have been some attacks on Lebanon, which have been reported. There's always the accusation by the Israelis that Hamas is supported by Iran. They may wish to use this as a pretext. And yesterday, of course, I should mention, they're firing rockets into Lebanon, okay? Now, why would they fire rockets into Lebanon? That was day before yesterday. Why would they do that? Is it not an act of provocation while they're at war in Gaza? I'm just wondering whether this whole military operation is not part of a broader agenda, which includes the Lebanese Syrian coastline, which is of course contiguous to Israel, and we have to understand that there was a war in Lebanon in 2006, so that this could be a prelude to a broader conflict, quite definitely, and it could be a pretext. it could be a pretext to waging a broader war, and at the same time, it could also escalate because there's a sense of tremendous indignation in the Arab world, and it's very, you know, difficult to predict what might happen in the next few months as far as the actions which might be taken, let's say, within Lebanon or Syria regarding this regarding the military operation in Gaza.
Michel Chosadovsky, thank you very much.
It's a great pleasure.
Is something happening here? Yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show has been The Invasion of Gaza. Michel Chosadovsky is a professor of economics and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. The Center for Research on Globalization is an independent research and media group of writers, scholars, and activists. Based in Montreal, the Global Research website at globalresearch.ca publishes news articles, commentary, background research, and analysis on a broad range of issues focusing on social, economic, strategic, geopolitical, and environmental processes. Chosadovsky is the author of The Globalization of Poverty, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, and America's War on Terrorism, as well as numerous articles. Today we focused on two of his most recent articles, The Invasion of Gaza, Operation Cast Lead, part of a broader Israeli military intelligence agenda, and War and Natural Gas, the Israeli invasion and Gaza's offshore gas fields. Visit Michel Chosadovsky's website at www.globalresearch.ca. That's globalresearch.ca.
Yeah. It's a shame that our kids are dumb, but our bombs are smart. What a lucky thing now. Don't you know it's a feel-good show, and it's suitable for the whole darn family. Come on out, everybody shout, give a big salute to our ingenuity. Don't you know this is better than any video friend? It's an action movie. Here we go, watch the bad guys get their butts kicked, and it makes me feel good. Don't you know it's Nintendo, really gets the blood flowing through my veins now. Don't you know it's a feel-good show, electronicness, it's a video, video. There they go now, there go all my friends. There they go now, marching off to war again, with their bright flags waving in the wind. There they go now, marching off to war again, smiling proudly. There they go now, there go all my friends. There they go now, marching off to war again, with their bright flags waving in the wind. There they go now, marching off to war again, smiling proudly, with their heads in the clouds. See them smiling out, marching on in the light. Yeah, 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 yeah. There they go now, yeah, 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 yeah. There they go now, yeah, 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 yeah. There they go now, there go all my friends. There they go now, marching off to war again.
I used to visit all the very gay places, those come what may places, where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life to get the feel of life.
I had a deep respect for Henry Kissinger, his knowledge, his background, and his philosophic outlook.
I thought he was intelligent, charming, and just a good companion.
I like Henry. I respect him. I think he has been a major force in our lives.
Dr. Kissinger is perhaps one of the major scholars in America and the world today in this area.
He was a fascinating mixture of power and strategy.
It wasn't just that power made you a celebrity. It's sometimes that just creating yourself as a celebrity gave you more power.
Let your poignant smile.
Everyone has a New York dream.
Thank you so much for visiting our plant, Dr. Kissinger.
It was fun.
We'll let you know if your glasses turn up.
I think Kissinger is clearly an extraordinarily brilliant man. But he did have this, I think, this fatal flaw of preferring to act without public scrutiny.
Well, in Harper's Magazine this month, there's an article called The Case Against Henry Kissinger, The Making of a War Criminal. Explain, Christopher.
I think he's a war criminal.
Yeah, look at it crash! Look at it crash!
I think he's a liar. I think he's responsible for kidnapping, for murder.
My own view is that if we held Henry Kissinger to the standards we have begun to hold other leaders, other policymakers, and the standards to which we held policymakers in Germany and in Japan after World War II, yes, Kissinger ought to be the subject of an international tribunal, ought to be the subject of a legal process in the United States and elsewhere.
What are we to make of these accusations? Henry Kissinger is the recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize and the most famous American diplomat in history. Yet, armed with recent evidence, his critics claim that some of his past actions amounted to crimes against humanity. In a new climate of international justice, a re-examination of Kissinger's career may be in order.
the important thing before people die or go senile, like Pinochet, is to punish them, to provide retribution for the victims, a sense that they haven't or their relatives haven't died in vain, and to provide a deterrent, to make dictators, tyrants, cruel people, be they generals or national security advisors, now think that if they take the wrong course and abuse their power, they may be held to and may be punished at some time in the future.
Jeffrey Robinson, human rights attorney.
Well, if I asked myself why I began my investigation into Henry Kissinger, it would go back as far as when I realized that he was a frightened man, because I became aware that he was personally frightened by the consequences of the arrest of General Pinochet. When the news of that hit, he instantly thought, could I be next?
Good evening.
Hitchens.
The former dictator of Chile, General Augusto Pinochet, has been arrested by police in London. The 82-year-old general is being held at the request of the authorities in Spain, who accuse him of the murder of Spanish citizens when he was in power.
In 1998, the front page of the New York Times announced that in cooperation with the case against General Pinochet, the U.S. government would release classified documents revealing American involvement in killings and torture in Chile. Kissinger may have received the news with some concern, as suggested by a phone call with his publisher, Michael Corder.
It's Mr. Corder for Dr. Kissinger. Henry, hi, how are you? No, I wasn't calling out of impatience. I was calling only to say that you're getting all the publicity you would want in the New York Times, but not the kind that you'd want. I also think it's very, very dubious for the administration to simply say, yes, they'll release these papers. This is a Spanish judge appealing to an English court about a Chilean head of state. So also Spain has no rational jurisdiction over events in Chile anyway, so that it makes absolutely no sense.
The day the British police, an arm of state power, go out to the house of Augusto Pinochet and declare him under house arrest,
law professor Michael Tiger,
is a victory for an idea about the protection of the right of all peoples.
Michael Tiger is a renowned litigator with a special interest in human rights and universal standards of justice.
So that's our basis. Now the next question is, well, who are we going to sue?
Tiger thinks that Henry Kissinger may have reason to be concerned about the new precedent set by the events surrounding the Pinochet arrest in London.
You know, here's this magistrate that everybody thought he's a good friend of Maggie Thatcher, and he's just going to toss the case out, right? Well, he writes one law for one world. That's what he wrote in his judgment. For me, I tell you something, the most dramatic moment of the hearing about Pinochet was the testimony of the Scotland Yard officer. On such and such a date, I was handed a warrant, and I went to a house. 11:30... I was shown in, and I went in, and I turned right. I then went into a room, and I saw a man that I recognized as the prisoner. Prisoner, isn't that a great room? The prisoner. And I walked up to him, and he stood, and I said, Augusto Pinochet Ugarte, I arrest you, sir, for the crimes of conspiracy and torture. And I tell you, I thought, busted. Busted.
I never like to miss a chance to confront Henry Kissinger, and I don't get that many, because when he knows I'm coming, or when he knows I'm going to be in the area, up till now he has cancelled, that's four times now this year. What I yearn for is the chance for some quality time with him. He refused to answer any questions when the Harper's articles were being written, but I do want to confront him and to make him realize that we're not going to stop asking.
In early 2001, author Christopher Hitchens published The Trial of Henry Kissinger. First released as two articles in Harper's Magazine, the book accuses the former Secretary of State of war crimes and crimes against humanity and asks for a formal legal inquiry.
The statement Henry Kissinger is a war criminal is a statement I've been making for many years. It's now not a piece of rhetoric, not a metaphor. It's a job description.
Across the U.S., Hitchens' improbable crusade attracted interest. With a pen for a lance, he was tilting at the windmill of Kissinger's reputation.
Christopher Hitchens, as you no doubt know, is out with a new book called The Trial of Henry A. Kissinger. It is very rough on you. It is a book devoted to criticism of you.
I'm not going to deal with Christopher Hitchens. He's a man who's attacked Mother Teresa, Jackie Kennedy. He said the Holocaust never existed. And I'm not going to do him the favor of getting into a debate with him.
I can't have it said that I'm an anti-Semite or a Nazi sympathizer. That, I'm sorry, is too much. It crosses my line. And Dr. Kissinger by now will have heard, I think, from my lawyers that he's to cease and desist from saying what he knows to be false.
I haven't read his book. I frankly was so disgusted by his magazine piece. Look at this guy's background. He's a sewer pipe sucker. He sucks the sewer pipe.
I was not concerned that Kissinger would sue Harper's Magazine, because then he, Kissinger, would have to go to some form of legal disclosure. I mean, if you accuse the magazine or you accuse Hitchens of libel, then that allows our lawyers to ask questions and subpoena documents.
Harper's editor Lewis
Lapham. Try to establish the truth of the matter, and that is not something I think that Kissinger would welcome.
Kissinger's admirers point to his impact as a global strategist. During the Cold War era, he saw international diplomacy as a grand game of finding the right balance between opposing superpowers.
I think that Kissinger's greatest accomplishment was a triangular diplomacy in which he was able to balance China off against the Soviet Union and have America retain a role in the world after Vietnam, when it would have been natural for us to retreat.
Kissinger's critics charged that his worldview blinded him to the human cost of the Cold War. Recently released documents reveal episodes in Indochina, Indonesia, and Chile, where Kissinger may have needlessly sacrificed human lives to pursue strategic goals.
That this man could operate at such a horrible level and not get exposed for year after year after year after year, how many people came out against him?
Seymour Hersh.
It's an embarrassment to my profession. I got to tell you, the dark side of Henry Kissinger is very, very dark.
The Americans started bombing Cambodia in 1969, soon after Nixon came into office, because they had a problem. The problem was that whole areas of eastern Cambodia, which was in theory a neutral country, not on the side of the North Vietnamese or the South Vietnamese, whole areas of the country had been taken over by the North Vietnamese communists.
William Shawcross. And they were using
them as staging areas and bases for their attacks on the South Vietnamese armies in South Vietnam and upon the American army in South Vietnam.
Cambodia, Thailand, they were going to overrun the whole peninsula.
This became one of those, the great myths of the Vietnam War, was that the key to success was getting rid of the Vietnamese communist bases on the Cambodian side of the border.
Cambodia's enigmatic Prince Sihanouk had managed to keep his country out of the Vietnam War. He hoped to avoid taking sides and so prevent an open violation of Cambodia's neutrality.
And this led to all sorts of problems, because taking the war secretly into a neutral country meant you had to destroy the actual records or to conceal them very effectively, to lie, in fact.
Well, it was the motivation was for the secrecy, because it was illegal. So, I mean, that's simple.
Under the U.S. Constitution, bombing Cambodia was an act of war that would require the approval of the U.S. Congress.
I don't know that Congress would have allowed it. The last thing Congress wanted then was an expansion of a war.
In February 1969, in a secret meeting on Air Force One, Kissinger and his aide, Alexander Haig, met with Air Force Colonel Ray Sitton to plan for the secret bombing of Cambodia.
What Kissinger wanted done was they asked Sitton to find a way to master bombing so nobody would know what's going on, and Sitton did. He found a way.
The initial secret bombing of Cambodia in 1969 was called Operation Menu, and each of the targets were different, or supposed to be different, North Vietnamese bases in Cambodia, and they were called after names of meals: breakfast, lunch, dinner, snack.
Starting with breakfast, Kissinger approved a plan to conceal the Cambodian bombing missions from military records. Under this dual reporting system, B-52 pilots would be pre-assigned targets in South Vietnam. In mid-flight, their planes would be rerouted by ground radar stations and guided to secret targets in Cambodia. The returning pilots would report that their bombs had been dropped on South Vietnam. Cambodia would never appear in the record.
I think Kissinger is clearly an extraordinarily brilliant man. Brilliant and also manipulative and also very secretive.
Under Kissinger's supervision, the U.S. flew 3,600 secret missions over Cambodia in 14 months, dropping 110,000 tons of bombs. Colonel Sitton recalled that Henry Kissinger was intimately involved in the direction and timing of the bombing raids.
Real attention to the cruelties of the details, picking targets, selecting hamlets and villages to be bombed.
It is an absurdity to say that a country can occupy a part of another country, kill your people, and that then you are violating its neutrality when you respond against the foreign troops that are on that neutral territory. It is total hypocrisy.
1 week after the first bombs had fallen in Cambodia, rumors of the operation began to surface in the press. Kissinger contacted the FBI to request that wiretaps be used to find the source of the leaks.
He wiretapped American journalists with whom he had supposedly friendly and close relations.
It legitimized me. There I was, a reporter, writer, commentator for the New York Times, and everybody felt a little creepy about, you know, here's this Nixon apologist writing for the Times. But then when it turned out that I was wiretapped, all of a sudden I was in a new fraternity.
William Sapphire.
Wiretapped aides and associates in the Pentagon.
I was one of the people who was wiretapped while serving under him. I cannot forgive him for being a party to it or for never apologizing.
Daniel Davidson.
It was not one of the things that filled me with wild joy. On the other hand, it also seemed a way by which it could be demonstrated that my staff was loyal. But I'm sure there were a complex of reasons that went into it.
To some, the wiretapping was just a part of a campaign by Kissinger to fortify his position as Nixon's deputy.
He was endlessly playing off his own staff one against the other and playing them off against the president.
And there was a lot of jockeying, particularly on Henry's part, for position.
And Kissinger was determined to accrete as much power as possible to him.
We used to joke that the real hostile foreign powers were not Moscow or Beijing or any of our rivals in the world. The real hostile powers were the rest of the American government, the Department of State, the White House staff, the CIA, the Defense Department. Those were Henry's principal adversaries because they were the rivals for power in Washington.
Like a moth to flame, Henry Kissinger was always attracted to his critics, and the best way to get him to return your phone call was to write something negative.
He understood more about my profession than most of us. He always understood if he could get the three networks and Time and Newsweek, he was home free.
Kissinger's enemies in Vietnam continued to haunt him. While the war dragged on, an official State Department delegation met with the North Vietnamese in Paris. But Kissinger was confident he could secure more favorable terms. He opened a second channel of secret talks with North Vietnamese negotiator Lê Duc Tho.
And we were told that those negotiations were to be kept secret, not only, of course, from the public, not only from the media, but also from the rest of the U.S. government. Neither the Secretary of State nor the Secretary of Defense were to know anything about it. And Henry was flying off quite secretly on weekends to meet with Lê Duc Tho and Swan Tree in Paris at a safe house. This was all very conspiratorial, full of intrigue, which he loved. He'd put out the story that he was meeting a girlfriend, Jill St. John, or someone in New York, when in fact he was in Paris negotiating with the North Vietnamese.
How do I get out of here?
We thought you weren't having a meeting today, sir.
Well, do something surprising.
It's getting to be difficult to have a secret rendezvous in Paris.
It certainly is.
You'll be meeting again tomorrow, sir.
We expect to, yes.
Kissinger's secret talks made little progress toward peace in Vietnam, but they did expand his power in Washington.
The negotiations that he conducted were a way of exercising his own control, establishing his own authority in the negotiating process.
As it became apparent that Nixon would turn to Henry for strategy, he gained in that influence, and he gained some more self-confidence and made an enormous contribution to Nixon's policy.
Nixon and Kissinger's Vietnam strategy was still entangled in Cambodia. The secret bombing had failed to destroy the sanctuaries. The North Vietnamese had formed an alliance with Cambodian communists and had moved deeper into the country. Prince Sihanouk, the one man capable of uniting the nation, was deposed in a CIA-supported coup.
The Cambodian coup set off a kind of chain reaction inside the American government, in Richard Nixon and in Henry Kissinger.
Denying CIA support for the coup, Kissinger and Nixon announced U.S. support for the coup leader, Lon Nol, who promptly attacked the North Vietnamese. North Vietnam counterattacked and moved even deeper into Cambodia.
They saw that as a challenge, again, to American strength, to the credibility of American foreign policy.
Nixon decided to invade Cambodia to send a message to North Vietnam. A few days before the invasion, Nixon had a friend relay a message to Kissinger. The president wants you to know, Henry, that if this doesn't work, it's your ass. Kissinger told his staff, our peerless leader has flipped out. But Kissinger defended and implemented the decision to invade, saying it would scare North Vietnam. Nixon would be more emphatic. He said, let's go blow the hell out of them.
I decided to resign, along with Tony Lake and with Bill Watts, our colleague on the NSC staff.
Roger Morris.
Because I felt that the Cambodian invasion was a betrayal of the president's pledge to seek an honorable and just peace in Vietnam. I knew that peace was within our grasp. I was intimately involved in the negotiations. I knew that the other side was ready to agree, that we were ready to agree, and that the Cambodian invasion really destroyed all of that, devastated it for years to come, and literally cost tens of thousands of American lives, hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese lives.
On April the 30th, 1970, U.S. forces invaded Cambodia.
Armed forces of South Vietnam, attacks are being launched this week to clean out major enemy sanctuaries on the Cambodian-Vietnam border.
As news of the invasion spread, the U.S. domestic reaction was explosive. Nearly 500 American universities shut down, and on the morning of May 4th, National Guardsmen opened fire on 15 students at Kent State University, killing four. As Nixon promised publicly to remove forces from Cambodia, Kissinger reviewed a plan to increase the pressure on North Vietnam to surrender.
Henry Kissinger began in the fall of 1969 in September to plan a savage, brutal blow against North Vietnam. These were his words. He said to us as a planning group, I can't believe that a fourth-rate power like North Vietnam does not have a breaking point.
For 11 days in December of 1972, in what became known as the Christmas bombing, 129 B-52 bombers dropped 40,000 tons of bombs on Hanoi and Haiphong, hitting a hospital and other urban centers. What many did not know was that Kissinger had struck a peace accord with North Vietnam 2 months before. But South Vietnam's President Thieu, the man who had undermined the 68 peace talks, would not accept the deal without proof that the Americans would enforce it.
The Christmas bombing had much more to do with the South Vietnamese than with the North. It was a gesture to the Thieu regime. It was a way of saying the United States is willing to make this one great last brutal blow against the North.
They bombed the North Vietnamese simply to persuade the South Vietnamese that they meant it. It was a demonstration bombing. It was a public relations mass murder from the sky.
The bombing did appease the South, and Kissinger persuaded the North Vietnamese to make a few cosmetic concessions, In January 1973, Kissinger signed a peace accord with North Vietnamese negotiator Lê Duc Tho. The terms of peace were almost identical to the terms the Johnson administration had nearly secured before the election of 1968.
Half the names on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial are incised in stone for dates after January 1969. There is enough marble in Washington to put all the names on one wall. We wouldn't dare try and put up a wall that had the names of all the Vietnamese on it who died in that period.
When I shall receive the award, together with my old colleague in the search for peace in Vietnam, Sir Lê Duc Tho,
in 1973, Kissinger and Lê Duc Tho were jointly awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace.
It will symbolize the end of the anguish and the suffering.
But to his embarrassment, Kissinger was unaware that Lê Duc Tho would not attend the ceremony in Oslo.
The Vietnamese counterpart with whom he shared it, Mr. Lê Duc Tho, refused to accept the prize on the perfectly excellent pragmatic grounds that there was no peace in Vietnam to celebrate, so there shouldn't be a prize for it.
I thought it was a terrible travesty that he should be awarded a peace prize when, in fact, he was a war maker, not a war ender.
Dr. Kissinger, what would you say was the high point of your tenure as Secretary of State?
Well, I would say
in
1973... when I won the Nobel Peace Prize for ending the Vietnam War.
And the low point?
I'd say 1975, when the Vietnam War ended.
You're listening to excerpts of the documentary The Trials of Henry Kissinger by Alex Gibney and Eugene Jarecki. As we move from Kissinger's involvement in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos to Chile.
Last year, Kissinger was enjoying a trip to Paris when a French judge served him with a subpoena to answer questions about U.S. involvement in Chile 30 years ago. At issue was Operation Condor, a campaign of murder and torture conducted by the regime of Augusto Pinochet.
The arrest of Augusto Pinochet in London in October of 1998 directly led to pressure on the Clinton administration to declassify hundreds of thousands of documents, secret documents from the CIA, from the State Department and elsewhere, blacked out as they are. These documents are really rather extraordinary. There's a paper trail right up to Kissinger's office that help us revisit this history and understand our efforts to overthrow covertly democratically elected government in Chile.
I really think Chile was probably the basis and the most corrupt of all the actions because it had nothing to do with national security.
Copper is used all over the world, but the largest known reserve of copper ore is in South America, in the Republic of Chile.
In the 1960s, Chile was fertile soil for American corporate interests, including AT&T, which controlled the copper industry, and Pepsi-Cola. Early in 1970, Pepsi and AT&T were concerned about political developments in Chile. As the country's democratic presidential elections approached, a left-wing candidate named Salvador Allende was gaining popular support. His ties to Fidel Castro were a particular concern.
He was the spokesman for Castro everywhere. As part of his electoral platform, he had said he would not accept American aid. He had inveighed against American capitalism, described the United States as not really being a democracy, but the Soviet Union was a democracy.
Allende promised to nationalize Chile's copper industry, a direct threat to AT&T and concern to other U.S. corporations.
I directed that an approach be made to both the State Department and Mr. Kissinger's office to tell them that we had grave concern over the outlook for AT&T's investment.
As AT&T called on Kissinger to take action against Allende, Pepsi President Donald Kendall echoed the same concern to an old friend, Richard Nixon.
If he does it right in Chile, he's going to ensure a good flow of campaign money in 71 and 72. He's got a lot of big money people that want him to do something about Chile. So Chile became the most important national security item they had.
What brought about the changes in Chile
were the facts that it was being communized by LND.
On September 4th, Allende won a plurality of the vote. It appeared certain that his victory would be confirmed by the Chilean Congress.
The election in Chile has been won, but the president has not been confirmed, the new president, Salvador Allende. Chile has, like the United States, a transition period of about 60 days.
The CIA declared that Chile under Allende would not be a threat to the United States, but Nixon found the prospect of an Allende presidency unacceptable.
As advisor to Richard Nixon, Kissinger followed Machiavelli's rule of flattering, adulating, and serving the powerful to be a success.
In a September meeting, Kissinger shared his views on Chile's democratic election. I don't see why we need to stand by and watch a country go communist due to the irresponsibility of its people. On September 15th, Nixon met in the Oval Office with Kissinger and Richard Helms, director of the CIA. Helms' handwritten notes reveal a plan to prevent Allende from coming to power. Not concerned risks involved. No involvement of the embassy. $10 million available, more if necessary. An internal CIA memo dated September 16th outlines the official but secret policy implemented by the CIA under the supervision of Henry Kissinger. Kissinger asked Helms to report directly to him on the details of coup operations. Concealed from the Departments of State and Defense, as well as the U.S. Embassy in Chile, this plan for covert action became known as Track 2.
Of course, that was a broad policy. I make no excuses for that. It should have been. Another Marxist regime in the hemisphere? No.
Alexander Haig.
In a meeting with Haig and others, Kissinger emphasized that drastic action was called for to shock the Chileans.
Kissinger really became the general manager of this covert operation, representing the President of the United States. He ignored the advice of his own staff that a coup was not possible.
I decided sending these increasingly worrying alarms to Kissinger that anything that might be tried would be an utter failure. The Chilean military was not going to engage in anything. Allende was certainly going to be elected. Nothing could stop it.
Kissinger swept aside these objections and pressed the CIA to go forward to foment a military coup.
But the third cable was the one that really excited Kissinger, because it said unequivocally that if any adventure were undertaken, it would boomerang against the United States and personally against the president worse than the Bay of Pigs. That was the cable that got me a summons home right away, because they thought I had stumbled on their plot.
Fine, we'll call you there.
So I flew to Washington. President greeted me. He then launched into a denunciation of Allende. He kept hitting his hand like that. He was going to smash Allende economically. Kept referring to him as that bastard, that SOB. He was going to smash him.
With the inauguration approaching, word of possible covert action against Allende reached General René Schneider, head of the Chilean military. Schneider announced he would uphold Allende's confirmation by the Chilean Congress. He was unaware that men from within his own ranks were being recruited by the CIA.
Mi padre era una persona muy tierna, sí. Mi papá era una persona que no mentía, que lo que decía lo cumplía.
René Schneider is the son of the former general. He said his father did not necessarily agree with Salvador Allende, but agreed in the Constitution that he would uphold the democratically elected president
as the principal obstacle to a military coup, because he believes the Chilean armed forces take their oath only to the Constitution.
In Santiago, the CIA helped design a plan to kidnap Schneider.
They thought they would provoke the military into declaring martial law, suspending the elections.
The CIA's Santiago station chief cabled Washington, "General Schneider is the main barrier to all plans for the military to take over." Washington cabled back, "Constant pressure from the White House, more important than ever to remove him."
It's therefore decided Schneider must go. And for this task, men of proven record of criminal violence are recruited.
Christopher Hitchens.
Given sophisticated assassination weaponry through the United States diplomatic bag.
A track to CIA communique confirms this. The cable reports that plans against Schneider were moving along, requesting 8 to 10 tear gas grenades, 3 45 caliber machine guns with 500 rounds ammo each.
And they're given large financial inducement.
The money was gathered and handled through a CIA channels back with
the... Colonel Paul Weimart, U.S. military attaché. He said no one sat on it long enough to hatch an egg. It was too hard to hold.
In late September, Weimart, then U.S. military attaché, had been secretly assigned to work directly with the CIA in Santiago. An avid equestrian, Weimart's love of horses had made him a close associate of officers in the Chilean military, an ideal go-between. The CIA station gave Weimart a war chest of cash to pay out to anti-Allende groups.
I couldn't put it in my office safe. I stuck it. It was done in long rubber bands, $250,000. And I put it in my riding boots, and no one else moved the boots but me. And that was the best place to keep it.
On October the 15th, Kissinger received word that Track 2 coup plotters had made a failed attempt to kidnap General Schneider. In a meeting with the CIA, he expressed his concern that plans for a coup at this time cannot succeed. In his memoirs, Kissinger would later write that he had turned off Track 2 at this meeting. But the very next day, the CIA sent a cable to Chile. It is firm and continuing policy that Allende be overthrown by a coup. It is imperative that these actions be implemented clandestinely and securely so that the United States government and American hand will be hidden.
If you're Henry Kissinger, everybody knows what you want. Does he know that they know what he wants? Sure. Does he know what they're going to do or how they're going to do it? Are you kidding? Anybody that would tell him what's going to happen is never going to do a briefing again. Do you really think somebody would take a piece of paper into the White House that say a consequence of this may be a death of somebody? Do you really think so? No.
Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds whisper. Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds just where people gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's there. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution. The doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds whisper. And finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution.
United States supported the brutal Somoza dictatorship in Nicaragua for over 40 years. The Nicaraguan people, led by the Sandinistas, overthrew this regime in 1979. A breathtaking popular revolution. The Sandinistas weren't perfect. They possessed their fair share of arrogance, and their political philosophy contained a number of contradictory elements. But they were intelligent, rational, and civilized. They set out to establish a stable, decent, pluralistic society. The death penalty was abolished. Hundreds of thousands of poverty-stricken peasants were brought back from the dead. Over 100,000 families were given title to land. 2,000 schools were built. A quite remarkable literacy campaign reduced illiteracy in the country to less than 1/7. Free education was established and a free health service. Infant mortality was reduced by 1/3. Polio was eradicated. The United States denounced these achievements as Marxist-Leninist subversion. In the view of the U.S. government, a dangerous example was being set. If Nicaragua was allowed to establish basic norms of social and economic justice, if it was allowed to raise the standards of healthcare and education and achieve social unity and national self-respect, neighboring countries would ask the same questions and do the same things. There was, of course, at the time, fierce resistance to the status quo in El Salvador. I spoke earlier about a tapestry of lies which surrounds us. President Reagan commonly described Nicaragua as a totalitarian dungeon. This was taken generally by the media, and certainly by the British government, as accurate and fair comment. But there was, in fact, no record of death squads under the Sandinista government. There was no record of torture. There was no record of systematic or official military brutality. No priests were ever murdered in Nicaragua. There were, in fact, three priests in the government, two Jesuits and a Maryknoll missionary. The totalitarian dungeons were actually next door, in El Salvador and Guatemala. The United States had brought down the democratically elected government of Guatemala in 1954, and it is estimated that over 200,000 people had been victims of successive military dictatorships. Six of the most distinguished Jesuits in the world were viciously murdered at the Central American University in San Salvador in 1989 by a battalion of the Alcatel Regiment, trained at Fort Benning, Georgia, USA. That extremely brave man, Archbishop Romero, was assassinated while saying Mass. It is estimated that 75,000 people died. Why were they killed? They were killed because they believed a better life was possible and should be achieved. That belief immediately qualified them as communists. They died because they dared to question the status quo, the endless plateau of poverty, disease, degradation, and oppression, which had been their birthright. The United States finally brought down the Sandinista government. It took some years and considerable resistance, but relentless economic persecution and 30,000 dead finally undermined the spirit of the Nicaraguan people. They were exhausted and poverty-stricken once again. The casinos moved back into the country. Free health and free education were over. Big business returned with a vengeance. Democracy had prevailed. But this policy was by no means restricted to Central America. It was conducted throughout the world. It was never ending. And it is as if it never happened. The United States supported, and in many cases engendered, every right-wing military dictatorship in the world after the end of the Second World War. I refer to Indonesia, Greece, Uruguay, Brazil, Paraguay, Haiti, Turkey, the Philippines, Guatemala, El Salvador, and of course, Chile. The horror the United States inflicted upon Chile in 1973 can never be purged and can never be forgiven. Hundreds of thousands of deaths took place throughout these countries. Did they take place? And are they, in all cases, attributable to U.S. foreign policy? The answer is yes. They did take place. And they are attributable to American foreign policy. But you wouldn't know it. It never happened. Nothing ever happened. Even while it was happening, it wasn't happening. It didn't matter. It was of no interest. The crimes of the United States have been systematic, constant, vicious, remorseless, but very few people have actually talked about them. You have to hand it to America. It has exercised a quite clinical manipulation of power worldwide, while masquerading as a force for universal good. It's a brilliant, even witty, highly successful act of hypnosis. I put to you that the United States is without doubt the greatest show on the road. Brutal, indifferent, scornful, and ruthless it may be, but it's also very clever. As a salesman, it is out on its own, and its most saleable commodity is self-love. It's a winner. Listen to all American presidents on television say the words, "the American people." As in the sentence, "I say to the American people, it is time to pray and to defend the rights of the American people. And I ask the American people to trust their president in the action he is about to take on behalf of the American people." It's a scintillating stratagem. Language is actually employed to keep thought at bay. The words "American people" provide a truly voluptuous cushion of reassurance. You don't need to think. Just lie back on the cushion. The cushion may be suffocating your intelligence and your critical faculties, but it's very comfortable. This does not apply, of course, to the 40 million people living below the poverty line and the 2 million men and women imprisoned in the vast gulag of prisons which extends across the United States. The United States no longer bothers about low-intensity conflict. It no longer sees any point in being reticent or even devious. It puts its cards on the table without fear or favor. It quite simply doesn't give a damn about the United Nations, international law, or critical dissent, which it regards as impotent and irrelevant. It also has its own bleating little lamb tagging behind it on a lead, the pathetic and supine Great Britain. What has happened to our moral sensibility? Did we ever have any? What do these words mean? Do they refer to a term very rarely employed these days? Conscience? A conscience to do not only with our own acts, but to do with our shared responsibility in the acts of others. Is all this dead? at Guantanamo Bay. Hundreds of people detained without charge for over 3 years, with no legal representation or due process, technically detained forever. This totally illegitimate structure is maintained in defiance of the Geneva Convention. It is not only tolerated, but hardly thought about by what's called the international community. This criminal outrage is being committed by a country which declares itself to be the leader of the free world. Do we think about the inhabitants of Guantanamo Bay? What does the media say about them? They pop up occasionally, a small item on page 6. They have been consigned to a no man's land, from which indeed they may never return. At present, many are on hunger strike, being force-fed, including British residents. No niceties in these force-feeding procedures. No sedative or anaesthetic. Just a tube stuck up your nose and into your throat. You vomit blood. This is torture. What has the British Foreign Secretary said about this? Nothing. What has the British Prime Minister said about this? Nothing. Why not? Because the United States has said to criticize our conduct in Guantanamo Bay constitutes an unfriendly act. You're either with us or against us. So Blair shuts up. The invasion of Iraq was a bandit act. An act of blatant state terrorism, demonstrating absolute contempt for the concept of international law. The invasion was an arbitrary military action, inspired by a series of lies upon lies and gross manipulation of the media and therefore of the public. An act intended to consolidate American military and economic control of the Middle East, masquerading as a last resort, all other justifications having failed to justify themselves as liberation. A formidable assertion of military force responsible for the death and mutilation of thousands and thousands of innocent people.
Take a Second and replaced by the one.